Stand up! Stand up! You're not dead! Oh, my heck! Stand up! Stand up, all of you! Oh, my heck! Is there not even one dead?
No, sir. Not one.
Why not?
They thought it was a practice, sir.
But all the bleeding and the groaning!
Little secreted sheep's bladders, sir.
Oh, my cock! Sheep's bladders? You're sour! A non-Semitic, mutinous, racially impure, clothed bunch of Roman lovers!
Sorry, sir.
Tomorrow, as a punishment, you will all eat pork sausages!
Oh, no!
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show, Friday the 1st of July 2022, streaming live from the PRSC Arts Centre in Bristol on the new talkradio.org.uk stream and at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. And we have been on various streams, but the best thing to do if you're going to tune in every week live is to bookmark talkradio.org.uk, and then you should be able to bring it up each week nice and easy. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner that's been gaslighting us with military grade Ukraine propaganda, and also, of course, COVID medical misinformation, where, according to Dr. Tess Laurie from Bath and the Ivermectin group, 60,000 Brits could have died unnecessarily during that, but those that misinformation, all forgotten. And of course, if you try and tell the truth on YouTube, they call it disinformation and ban you. The transmitter and printing press owners turning society into a hostile environment for workers, readers, listeners, viewers, oh, and particularly gypsies. Instead, navigating us through the Fourth Reich Matrix or the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, who's joining us on the line. And from the PCS Union, it's Justin Thomas. Hi, Justin. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, Tony. Thanks. Great to be here.
We're going to be running through just two. We had three parts last week, didn't we? The past, present and future. Never done that before, which is a bit of a bizarre way to do a radio show. So we only had a kind of hour in the middle where we were dealing with current affairs. But it's going to be pretty much all current affairs this week. And we'll start by just, if you could just tell us a little bit about what the PCS is, Justin, and what you do.
Yeah, sure. So PCS is the Public Commercial Services Union. And we look after civil servants in the UK. So clearly they're a little bit under the hammer at the moment with the government wanting to get rid of 91,000 of their number. I'm a full-time officer with the PCS. I suppose I should say that I'm speaking in a personal capacity this evening with you. I do want to talk about the issues that are facing civil servants and also the wider stuff around strikes and disputes and the economic situation.
Okay, so you're working for the union. Were you a civil servant yourself?
No, I never was. I was a public sector worker. I was a firefighter for 17 years, working in Wiltshire and in Avon. And then when I decided that that was the end of that career, I went to work for the NESUWT and then for PCS.
So what was it about the firework that turned you on to union work?
I think when I first got into the fire service, I was very much told to keep my mouth shut and keep my head down. I was quite old when I joined. I was 28, which is probably older than most people. And then we had an issue on our fire station. We were a station that provided cover basically 24 hours a day for 3 days in a row. And the guys had children and partners, and the partners had to work and sometimes do night shifts and things like that. And the brigade just came down and said, you're going to crew the trucks the whole time. And I watched the guys kind of standing up for
themselves. Don't they have three shifts?
Not in that situation. No, it was only two shifts, and it was like 3 days about each. It's a thing called day crewing. But, you know, I won't get into all of the intricacies of that. But basically what happened was it was an issue. The brigade weren't dealing very well, and I thought, you know what, I've got to get involved. And within about 2 months, I was on the local branch committee, which is the workplace in the fire service. And then I went up. Yeah, I just got involved, health and safety, branch chair, and then became chair in Wiltshire.
Okay, so how did you go in that particular dispute that got you involved? Did you win it or not? A bit, or maybe you sort of win it a bit, don't you?
I think that's right. I think that's really true, Tony. I think in hindsight, I can't recall the last time a group of workers got 16%, across 2 years. we did that then. I know there's some who are getting close now, and rightly so. But yeah, I mean, at the time we all came out of it, I think we felt pretty bitter, 2003 going into 2004, and it did cause a lot of internal ructions within the FBU. But yeah, now with the benefit of hindsight, it's 20 years ago. Looking back, I think we did incredibly well, and I think it politicised and changed a lot of things, and it certainly changed me.
Well, it's good for morale, isn't it, when you can get at, what is that, 8% annual pay increase for your members? That's fantastic for morale. It makes them feel like they want to turn up for work in the morning, and also they want to pay their union fees.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and I mean, it was never the cheapest of unions. It was always pretty expensive to be part of it, but it was a small union. And I think that we really punched above our weight, and I guess the guys still do. You know, but it did sort of lead to devastating cuts to the fire service, really, and the numbers are probably half what they were when that dispute happened.
Okay, so was that under the Cameron government or the Brown government?
No,
what was happening?
That was definitely under Blair, and that was
Blair.
Yeah, right. And that was right in the throes of the second.
So
Gulf
the cuts,
War.
The cuts too.
And then the cuts came in, yeah, under New Labour across the next sort of 3 or 4 years.
Martin, do you want to say something about that? Because surely the Labour Party is there to defend the rights of people like Justin.
Well, it's the Labour Party is a major political party, obviously founded initially by the trade unions, but trade unions have got to be independent of all of that if they're going to defend their members. So I believe PCS is not affiliated with the Labour Party. Is that correct?
No, that's correct, yeah, because we've been Civil Servants Union. We're not affiliated to any political party.
Yeah, and I think probably, the problem for the Labour Party is that the funding for the party has always come from the unions. And then when we had the Corbyn era, there was a lot of massive increase in membership. And so because everybody's paying their dues, the party was actually quite flush with funds. But one of the things that Keir Starmer has done is he settled out of court with various apparatchiks who claimed that they'd been discriminated against for anti-Semitic reasons. And the legal advice the Labour Party had was that if it went to court, they'd lose. But Starmer decided that he was going to pay them off. So he paid them off, and they took millions of pounds out of the Labour Party's coffers, those people. And I do resent that as a member since 1975. That's my money. I've paid in over every year, for years and years and years. And now the Labour Party's strapped for cash because these people who are basically saboteurs have been paid off with the money that everybody's paid in.
Yeah, Martin, that's not really what I asked you about, though. I asked you about. I mean, because Blair and Brown are not prepared to fight for public sector workers back in the noughties, and they can't really expect to get the unions behind them, can they?
Well, there's always going to be a tense relationship for obvious reasons, because unions represent their members and the Labour Party isn't a union. And ultimately, what you've got in Scandinavia is that political parties are funded by society, by the government, and that actually takes a lot of money out of politics. But of course, we're moving in the direction, like you've seen in the US, where corporate interests fund politics, and therefore they demand what they want.
Well, a tense
That's
relationship.
Like unions have to be somewhere. The unions have to be independent of all of that and defend.
A tense relationship, maybe, but that doesn't really exist, it seems, between the private equity firms and the Tory party, does it?
No. I mean, trade unions are open organisations, as is the Labour Party, and so any rows are out in public. Whereas what goes on behind closed doors when the private equity people meet Tory ministers, occasionally it leaks out, doesn't it? When Jenrick was caught, giving Desmond planning permission to build buildings and so on. British politics is very, very corrupt, but it's the same all over the world. It's, politics is money doesn't talk, it swears, isn't it?
So, Justin, can you just give us your take on the, particularly on the RMT strike? We covered it you know, pretty comprehensively last week.
Yeah, sure.
This is the, well, from both sides, really, with Mick Lynch explaining that actually the government, through the Department for Transport, were directly interfering in the talks, and it's quite obvious that the government want those talks to go on and on and on. They don't want a settlement. They're trying to break the rail union, the RMT, rather like Thatcher broke the back of the miners back in the 1980s.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think one thing I would like to say is that there was a fantastic show of support last week on Saturday for the RMT in Bristol. You know, we had at least 8-9 unions out and other political groups as well, all supporting the RMT, marching around Temple Meads and then marching on to Castle Park, where we had a bit of a rally. And I think that this dispute with the RMT has really captured the public, you know, mood and support. I think it's I think the support's been pretty good out there, to be honest. I stood on a couple of picket lines this week. I also went to the St Monica's one. And in general, I think people understand that workers are suffering. They can see the cost of living. They appreciate, you know, everybody appreciates how much it's costing when you go to the shops. You might be able to afford it yourself, but you can still see the price rises going up. So actually, I think there's a lot of support out there. So I think that's why it's important to mention that strike. I guess as well, Tony, if you just indulge me a minute, I think some of the parallels with 2002 and the fire service are clear again. What you said a minute ago about the interference of government. I mean, government were all over the fire service dispute, even though the employers are the local authorities. And you know, John Prescott allegedly getting pulled out of bed to, you know, to say no to a deal that we'd cut. The FBU had cut with the employers at that time. And I think you can see those same sort of things again. And there's that same narrative again about, you know, this is an essential public service. How dare you go on strike? You know, we're going to legislate to stop this happening, et cetera, et cetera. And we've heard these things over and over. And I just don't think it's going to wash. I don't think they are going to be able to legislate to stop the strikes. I mean, there's so much legislation around strike action anyway. I don't really think, apart from banning them outright, there's much else they could do. And I just don't think that's going to be... I think that would be a step too far. So, yeah, I was just interested, really, thinking it had been 20 years and thinking how little things had shifted in that 20 years, and we were effectively having the same arguments rehearsed once more with the RMT as we did with the FBU.
Well, it's not just you saying that people support them. It's also an independent poll released by the RMT last Saturday, commissioned by them. Independent polling released by the RMTs found strong support for rail workers to receive a fairer deal from the government and for the government to intervene to address the rail workers' concerns. A clear majority of the public also support the rail workers' right to strike when the negotiations fail. In a blow to the rail companies and the government, the poll also revealed widespread opposition to plans to cut thousands of rail jobs and showed the public also clearly opposed the government policy of allowing profiteering from the rail industry. The national poll of 2000 carried out by Opinium found that only 17% support the cuts to the staff on trains and stations and only 16% support the cutting of safety critical workers from inspecting and maintaining the rail tracks. Opposition to both, this is what they call modernisation, yeah? Opposition to both of these measures is high at 63% and 70% respectively. So 70% of the public believe rail workers should have a negotiated pay rise that takes into account the cost of living, while only 11% disagree. Well, they're pushing against an open door, really. At least the Labour Party should be in supporting this, with 70% of the public behind these rail workers. Roughly 60% believe that rail workers have the right to strike if negotiations fail, and only 18% are against this. And the 62% believe the government should intervene to ensure the rail companies reach the meet the rail workers' concern. Only 14% are against this. Now, this is a little bit finer, 62% saying the government should intervene. Well, actually, what Mick Lynch was saying on the Preston show last week is that the government most definitely are intervening, but they're intervening negatively to come and say, well, these previously settled disputes should be back on the table again in order to put the RMT on the back foot and say, well, you know, we've got agreements over guards on trains. We're going to tear those agreements up, the government and the rail companies want to, in order to wrong foot the negotiating process from the rail workers' point of view.
Yeah, I mean... I think this I think this safety, I was chuckling when you were saying about 16% being in favour of like reducing safety or whatever the figure was, you know. It just seems amazing that people are prepared to say, yeah, I'm fully supportive of taking safety measures away. I think, yeah, the government absolutely are intervening. I mean, we know that. I mean, they hold the purse strings, don't they? Because all these privatised companies are working from money that the government pays to them from taxpayer money, as the subsidies. So they've absolutely got the control in this. I think the control that most people want to see in this country is the railways taken back into public ownership. That's the answer. A couple of them are, and I think we want the rest back.
Yeah, well, that's right. There's three. There's Northern Rail, there's LNER, and then there's Southern, are all actually the shareholders are the government. So to a certain extent, the Mick Lynch and his friends are actually negotiating with the government, even though they kind of tried to deny it and they're trying to sneakily be there behind the scenes to pull the rug out from underneath the negotiations if it looks as if Network Rail and the train operating companies are going to come to a settlement. The final figure from the poll is 84% of the public believe the profits from the rail industry should be invested in protecting jobs and services, as opposed to 16% say they should go towards shareholder dividends. Well, I suppose those 16% are probably the shareholders. But we've got a sort of structural problem here, haven't we? We've got the companies that actually own the rolling stock. We've got the rail track that used to be now Network Rail that owns the track. Then you've got the train operating companies. You've got at least three kind of rackets in there pulling mm-hmm. profits out. And at least two of those three have got shareholders banging on the doors of their six-figure sum paid directors saying, where's our cut?
Yeah, I heard a former BR executive once talking, I must have been about 5 years ago, and he said, look, the only people who've really made any profit out of all this is the lawyers and the paint companies from having the liveries changed on the trains all the time, you know. But yeah, I mean, clearly there's plenty of profit being extracted. And again, this is really going on, you know, right across the public sector as well. I mean, you know, if I could just bring it to those 91,000 job cuts.
Well, this is what I was going to talk about, because sure. This was an announcement by Jacob Rees-Mogg, bless him, from one of our local MPs here, just down towards, is it Bath and North East Somerset, I think. He just sort of said, oh, we're going to sack 90,000 civil servants. And then that was it. We didn't hear really much more about it. So, I mean, that sounds to me pretty shocking. First of all, how many civil servants are there? What proportion of that is it? Because that sounds like quite a lot.
That's a fifth.
A fifth of all the civil servants to go.
Yeah.
And so how did this go down?
Well, I mean, obviously it's not gone down very well. And I would like to say, as someone who sits in negotiations with a government department, it hasn't gone down particularly well with the government departments either. And they've been scurrying around for the last 6 weeks trying to pull a plan together. And the Cabinet Office said to them, you need to impose 20%, 30% and 40% cuts. They wanted a plan for how they were going to do this. Because clearly some of the government departments are going to come back and say, look, we just cannot achieve what you want us to achieve. And I guess what they'll try and then do is marry up, like maybe a department who's doing 20% with a department who thinks they can do 40%. I can't imagine any of the departments are going to think they can do 40%. So there has been a lot of pushback from the departments, you know, sometimes from the Secretary of State as well, and also from the Perm Secs, to say, you know, a lot of this just isn't achievable. And
so these Perm Secs, these are your like Sir Humphreys from, from Prime Minister and all that. So what? Tell me a bit about this power dynamic between the ministers and the top civil servants, because, you know, you get a new minister every 5 minutes, it seems, yet these people at the civil service, they're there for a very, very long time.
Well, they're not always there for a really long time. They're not there for... No, it's not what it would have been like, you're saying, yes, Prime Minister times, yeah? I mean, there's a bit of a revolving door now between industry and between the head of the top of the civil service. And sometimes they want to bring people in with industry experience to try and shake things up a bit. But yeah, I mean, the relationship should, in theory, be quite good. But you always got to remember that the civil servants, you know, even the perm secretaries, are not political appointments. They're meant to be there for the good of the nation, for the good of the taxpayer. And also, you've got to remember, they're going to look after their flock a little bit. They're going to look after their department. They're going to look after their staff. So that doesn't always make an alliance.
Okay, so hang on. You've got a particular possible problem here,
yeah,
with bringing people in from industry of revolving doors, haven't
mm-hmm.
you? So an industry that's got quite a lot of lobbying clout then brings somebody into the civil service. They've got even more power in there. And there must be questions about whether their loyalty is to the public, to the government, or whether it's to their private business that they've come from.
Yeah, well, obviously, we have to, you know, occasionally, not as often as we'd like, I'd add, Tony, we have to sit in the room with these people or certainly go onto online meetings. So we're not going to directly accuse them of anything like that. And to be fair, a lot of them are pretty decent. And like I was going to say, they're trying to look after their people. They're also trying to look after the delivery of the department. You know, if you're the Department of Work and Pensions, for example, you know, you want to make sure that that stuff goes out, but you've also got to adhere to government policy, and that's sometimes where the issues come. But I don't think any of them, from what we're understanding, can 100% stand behind what the government's asking them to do at the moment.
So do you think there will be the 90,000? Is this just hot air from Rees-Mogg?
I think what we're going to look at is mid-July, and we're going to see the returns have gone in today. So they've got a couple of weeks for the Cabinet Office, the Treasury and the politicians to assess it all. And then I think we're going to possibly see some fury coming back to the department saying, why on earth haven't you done what we told you to do? Why have you only gone for the lower limit? We know some departments have not put in a 30% and a 40% figure because they say it's just impossible. So I think it's going to be really interesting what the government come back with. Look, I'd like to say it's going to be hot air, because ultimately I know it's kind of vogue in, you know, some of the tabloids to really hate on the civil service, but I would say our members did a fantastic job the last 2 years through COVID. Yeah, they were absolutely working from home, but they needed to do that to, one, do the job, and two, be safe to be able to keep delivering. And that's exactly what they did. I think they kept this country on the rails, frankly. No pun intended with the RMT, but they kept things going. And really, a lot of them are turning around saying, well, this is the reward we get. You know, that's the direct sort of messaging we get.
I mean, there were some horrific problems, though, weren't there? For example, with the passports and driving licenses.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What was
that
all about?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, I mean, that's the same regional sort of hub as we are. So the DVLA in Swansea, they had the most serious widespread outbreak of COVID in any industrial situation in this country, mainly because they just weren't, in the local management were not allowing the people to adhere to the government guidance, frankly. So, you know, we had a situation where the employer, the government, was breaking the government's own rules.
So what do you mean? That they're forcing them to come in?
Yeah, forcing them to come in, yeah.
And as they're coming in, surely they should be maybe taking a test before they come to work, that sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of this kicked off before testing was
widespread.
Right, okay,
before the test,
be,
yeah,
you know,
fair enough.
But yeah, certainly, I mean, they were constantly told that there was no way they could work from home. PCS absolutely argued with that. We appreciated there was some work that needed to be done. You know, there always has been. You know, it doesn't matter if it's defence, DWP or whatever. There's things like printing, and there's some stuff that still involves opening envelopes. So that couldn't be done at home. But what we needed was the measures in place. And certainly, as you alluded to, people were being kept too close together. So basically, it was like, get back to your desks, sit as close as you did in 2018, 2019. No provisions in place. And yeah, the inevitable happened, you know, the outbreak was brought into the workplace and then it spread in there.
But I mean, don't you worry, as a trade unionist, though, that all this working from home could mean that ultimately those jobs get outsourced? I mean, you know, I don't think
that's going to be the thing that causes outsourcing. I thought you were going to say, don't you worry about the organising. And yeah, obviously we have to have a mind to the organising. Although I would say that PCS did a fantastic job with DVLA around having online meetings, and they were some of the best online meetings. And I mean, you know, the percentages were high, like sort of 70, 80% of the members coming to those online meetings. And we just wouldn't have got those in the flesh even before COVID, you know. So in that respect, it's an organising problem. But also you've got remember that a lot of our members have, you know, issues in their personal lives that really are helped by having home working. So we're a little bit, you know, we're having to to walk a narrow path on this one.
But, I mean, surely, I mean, this is one of the things that employers have been doing over the last probably decade or so, is saying, oh, it's okay, you can work from home. And then you get a little letter in the post saying, hey, we're offering you redundancy because we can actually get someone to do this on a phone, on a computer from India, cheaper.
Yeah, I mean, we've had some government departments who have outsourced security work and things like that to overseas, and they've held information on servers. That's pretty sharply been brought back to the UK. So we don't see that as being an issue. We've got, you know, guarantees from the civil service that that sort of thing won't happen.
And how many people are in the PCS union? How many members?
I think that's a bit of a sensitive subject, you know. I'll tell you why. The employer chose to stop Checkoff in 2015, which is where they take the money straight out of the subs. So until then, they knew exactly how many people we had because they could count it. As it was the government that decided to stop that, that was under Francis Maude, we don't declare our membership openly anymore because it's their own fault. They lost that access.
Okay, well, I'm going to guess. Okay, it was probably about 500,000, is it?
I mean, I think it was before that.
Maybe 400,000.
400,000-ish.
But I mean, that's actually pretty. You know, I mean, Martin, maybe you can chip in here. If you compare it to something like the Labour Party, it's probably more than the Labour Party have as members, isn't it? No.
Yeah. Well, yes, it's comparable. And if you think about it, to run a country as complex as and as populous as Britain, that's not exactly a large number of people, is it? And I've got a background in economics. I mean, what is the point of sacrificing 90,000 civil servants to the Aztec gods of the market? I mean, why does Rees-Mogg think that putting all these people out of work is going to do some good for the economy? Everybody said, well, they've got to cut back. Why? What is the point? There's no point. It doesn't achieve anything. If anything, what it does is takes effective demand out of the economy and makes the possibility of a recession, which is pretty likely anyway, even more likely. So why do it? They just live in a world of their own where it's a good thing to sacrifice civil servants because it's a good thing. And you say, well, why? And they just haven't got an answer.
Well, answer, Martin, I'm sure their answer would be because it's less of a burden on the taxpayer.
Yeah, but the point is that this is the whole argument for austerity. When Osborne was a chancellor, when you cut public expenditure, what happens is that effective demand in the economy starts to go down, and then the economy starts to go down as well, and then the budget deficit increases. Osborne lost the country's AAA credit rating. You'd have thought they'd have learned the lesson by now, but they're stupid ideologists. They do the same thing every time, even though there isn't an economic case for it. The obvious thing to do when you're rebuilding after a big shock like the pandemic is to actually strengthen all of the things that civil servants do so that the economy can function on an upward trajectory. What is the point of taking effective demand out of the economy?
Yeah.
It just makes things worse.
No, I totally agree, Martin. And I mean, obviously, you know, they're kind of arguments that we are running with the government, with the departments, and also talking to our members about this sort of stuff. I mean, there's a fair chunk of civil servants who are actually on the minimum wage. You know, that does still happen. You know, we've got Ministry of Defence guards, for example, who are on the minimum wage. Technically, there is overtime, there is some sort of allowances and things like that. But their basic pay is the minimum wage. So, as you say, if you're going to make 91,000 people redundant, you're taking out of the economy the very people who spend pretty much all their money in this country. You know, they're certainly not offshoring it in tax havens or anything like that. So these are the very people that we want to keep in work. And the other thing that we're doing as a union is we're trying to turn around to the departments and say, well, what exactly are you going to stop doing? These people facilitate the activity of the country, like you said. You know, it takes a lot of people to run a country of 70 million, I heard it is the other day now. You know, with all the things that we expect in life, civil servants deliver that stuff. And if they're going to be cut, then our demand is, well, what is going to stop? You know, is it going to be defence? Is it going to be health? You know, is it going to be welfare?
Is it going to be the nuclear inspectorate, for example. I mean, this is quite an important little aspect of what the government does. Just looking at the figures for these parties and for your union, Justin, so you've got around about 400,000 members, around about the same amount as the Labour Party had, although it's fallen since Keir Starmer took over. The Conservatives, well, 160,000. So, Martin, why is it that, you know, people like Justin here and you, you know, the PCS Union and the Labour Party combined can't really take on the Tories, it seems? The Tories are the ones in charge. You know, they're steering the ship.
Well, it's because it isn't just a question of headcount and numbers, is it? The trade unions organise people who are, you know, have to go out to work for a living. Political parties, you know, most Labour Party members are workers of one kind and another, but our society isn't run by those people, is it? When the banks failed in 2008, if you were going to follow a free market philosophy, a real, genuine free market philosophy, you'd have simply allowed the banking system to collapse, which would probably have led people like Rees-Mogg, who's a hedge fund manager, to lose all of his money. But of course they didn't do that, because that would have also led to a massive crash in the economy and the society for everybody. But once you've bailed them out, I can't see any case whatever for not running the financial system as a public utility. And these kind of arguments were being made during the Corbyn era, and I think they're going to be made again as we go into probably what is going to be the biggest recession, depression in modern history in the next 18 months, 2 years.
Okay, well, what we're starting to look at is the cost of living crisis, as they call it. I mean, it seems to me that there's a lot more to it than meets the eye. One of the major problems, Martin, is inflation. I wonder if you can say, give us your view about what's been causing this now. We're projected 11% inflation this year. It's an enormous spike. I mean, I know, you know, I was saying a couple of weeks ago that this extra 20 pence green tax on diesel and petrol, which was sneaked in by the oil companies over the Christmas holiday, that certainly is, you know, that this has massive knock-on effects which aren't being pinned on the green lobby. But anyway, what do you make of inflation, and you know, what mitigating circumstances should be taken in order to stop prices rising so sharply, particularly for basic goods and services, you know, things like food?
Well, this inflation is primarily a supply-side inflation, a bit like the oil price shock in the 1970s. So it's not because people have got too much money in their pockets. It's because the supply side of the economy has been affected very badly by the pandemic, and of course, the oil price rises, which is not just to do with what's happening in the Ukraine. This has been, you know, these things are built into the global setup.
Okay, well, I've noticed I've noticed over the last couple of weeks the government spokespeople constantly saying, well, we can't allow too big a pay rises because this will cause inflation.
Yeah, but that's because they are projecting the idea of a wage price spiral as we saw in the 1970s. But in the 1970s, in actual fact, ordinary working people it was actually not bad for people who were properly unionized in places like Britain and Scandinavia and even in the United States. As long as people got an inflation plus pay rise, they were all right. The problem was it was eating into the profits of the capitalist classes. And that's why they had to stop that kind of way of running things, which, of course, is what the Reagan-Thatcher counter-revolution was all about. But in actual fact, if you look at, you know, well-managed countries like Norway or Finland, the unions bargain centrally with the employers' federations. In Sweden, they made them form an employers' federation. In the 1930s, the employers didn't want to have one. And the union said, no, you're having one, and we'll negotiate with that. And if you've got national bargaining, you can then tweak pay increases to make sure that people's living standards are protected. But also, because it's national pay bargaining, more efficient firms get a little bit of a boost because they have to pay just the national rate. Less efficient firms get a little bit of a push downwards. And what that does is ultimately leads to inefficient firms being pushed out, more efficient firms being supported. And ultimately, that's what it looks like if trade unions run the economy. And that's how they run things in Scandinavia. And Britain could be classified as a Scandinavian country. We could have been one of those countries, but instead we chose to be the 53rd state, and that's why we're in the mess we're in.
51st, isn't it?
Well, whatever it is.
Okay,
the
anyway.
Point, the point is that other comparable countries in Northern Europe have had very strong trade unions for decades, and far from undermining the efficiency of their economies, the productivity per hour in Sweden and Finland is far higher than it is here. But the unions are strong.
But in order to do something about inflation, Martin, is it as simple as going back to last summer's fuel price levels? Because the thing with fuel, and I mean, this is something most definitely true, that nobody, you don't need half a brain to figure this one out, that if fuel prices go up, as they have done, nearly 50% over the last 18 months, then, maybe not quite 50%, no, it's more like... sort of 30%-ish, isn't it? That everything goes up in price, because that fuel is used to move things around the country. It's used to, you know, industrial processes to make things. Everything is going to be more expensive. It's going to be more expensive for people to just make stuff, and it's been more expensive for people to deliver services all over the place. So if anything is going to cause inflation, surely it's going to be fuel.
Well, in the 1970s, the oil price shock was caused by the 1973 Yom Kippur War, when the Israelis attacked the Syrians, and or the Syrians and the Egyptians attacked them, and the Israelis defeated them, and the Arab countries decided to raise the price of oil because they've got a cartel. Although in actual fact, it looks like the Americans were quite happy with that, because they did a deal with the Saudi Arabians that everybody would have to buy oil in dollars. Now that's sort of big geopolitics is underpinning what's going on now. As you've seen, they've tried to sanction Russian oil and gas, but it's actually increased the price of oil and gas, which is not actually causing a problem for the Russians. So they're selling less oil and gas, but they're getting more money for it. So underlying all of this is these big geopolitical contests. But under any circumstances, the way to deal with inflationary shocks is not to load all the losses onto the less wealthy part of the population. If you have incomes policies, and I know incomes policies were very controversial in this country in the 70s because the unions were often opposed to them, but in Scandinavian countries, incomes policies have worked. It means that unions have actually had a seat at the top table, both with employers and with government, and by having national bargaining, you've actually created a situation where you can make a more efficient economy than you can in this country, where everything's basically a shambles. Look at all the different railway companies that are now being negotiating with the RMT. Just think how much more straightforward it would be to have a nationalised industry with a national bargaining structure where everybody knew where they stood.
Justin, can you just say something about the conditions, paying conditions of your members over the last few years? How have you managed to, the wages managed to keep up with inflation as it has been?
No, I mean, it's a really good point, Tony. And I think, as Martin was talking there, I was just thinking one key demand of PCS is that we want centralised bargaining back with the government. What they did was they absolutely atomised all the government departments, so we have to negotiate with about 16 government departments. Then they also brought in the outsourcing, so you know, just in the area that I work in, I negotiate with about 9 separate outsourcers, all working for the government department that I'm attached to.
These outsourcers, they have contracts with the government. Yep. Surely the government could just say, you know, have a clause in the contract about pay, so the government would organise.
Well, this is a personal view. I'm strongly of the belief that there was always a clause in the contract, and it was set at the Bank of England's expected rate of 2%. It was always 2%. Whenever you negotiated with these people, you'd never really get beyond 2%. But they have gone beyond 2% this year. But your question was about, you know, the last sort of 10 years and things like that. Certainly. We would have loved to have had some kind of bargaining power over the government to have stopped the austerity that our members and, frankly, other public sector workers have gone through in the last 10 years. I was talking to a guy this morning, and he said that his pay is £200 a month more than it was in 2012. And, you know, inflation hasn't been you know, much less than 1.52% all the way through that period. And clearly we're in a ridiculous situation with it now, where even CPIH, which is the lowest measure, is running at about 9%.
So that's an inflation measure.
Yeah.
So what about the current round? How's things going?
I have to be a bit careful what I say. Look, let me put it this way, that PCS is intending to ballot on a range of industrial issues in September. So in early September, we're going to ballot our civil service members. And at the moment, it's looking like all of them. And we're going to ballot them over pay, pensions, because our members are paying too much in their pensions. That's been assessed 3 years ago. We know that they're overpaying by about 2%, and the government's making no attempt to either give them more benefits or to cut the amount that they pay. And then we're also going to ballot over cuts to the compensation scheme, which is the scheme that essentially makes redundancy a little bit more expensive than the regular statutory terms. So it should make government departments think before they, number one, take on excessive amounts of people, and then number two, try to get rid of them again. So it's there as a bit of a leverage on them to think sensibly before they recruit and then decide to get rid of people again. But obviously it's going to make it much easier for the government to get rid of people if they can make it cheaper for themselves to get rid of people. And then finally, obviously, we've got the opposition to the 91,000 job cuts.
Okay, so let's just move on and have a listen to some of the clips from this week's Prime Minister's questions. And we had a delightful situation of Angela Rayner, the Deputy Labour leader, debating with Dominic Raab, who is the Justice Secretary, I believe. And so one of their topics that they chose to talk about, or Angela chose to ask about, and we do tend to get questions from the Prime Minister, or Dominic Raab in this case, to the opposition as well, which, I think the Speaker really, as soon as they start asking questions of the opposition, the Speaker should just pull them up and say, you can't do that, and stop them, basically. But anyway, and there was a lot of chit-chat this week, but largely one of the discussions that they had was about growth, putting growth policies in place. But the cost of living strikes and the cost of living crisis, and which is what we were just talking about with Justin there. And we'll pick up on what you make of this, Justin, after we've heard from Angela Rayner and Dominic Raab.
Angela Rayner.
Mr. Speaker, if he tends to empathise with those struggling with the Tory cost of living crisis, when it was he himself who once said that food bank users are not in poverty but simply have a cash flow problem. The Honourable Member doesn't. He spent over £1 million in 9 months on private jets. It shows how out of touch this government is, Mr. Speaker. But at this rate, by 2030, 1 million more people will be using food banks. How many more working people will be pushed into poverty by his Prime Minister before he says enough is enough?
Yeah. I tell you, if the Labour Party, if the Right Honourable Lady wants to help working people, they should be clear in standing up against these militant, reckless strikes. The Right Honourable Lady has flip-flopped. The Right Honourable Lady has flip-flopped all over the place when it came to these strikes. First she said they were lose-lose. Then she tweeted workers that were left with no choice. When she was asked by the BBC, straight question, she's normally a straight-shooting politician, do you like the RMT? She said, I'm going to have to go now. I've got a train to catch. She talks about working people. She talks about working people. Where was the Right Honourable Lady when the comrades were on the picket line last Thursday? Where was she when the Labour front bench were joining them rather than standing up for the public? She was at the Glyndebourne Music Festival, sipping champagne, listening to opera. Champagne socialism is back in the Labour Party.
That's from a clip from this week's Prime Minister's questions. Not answering the question at all. Anyway, what do you think is at the heart of this cost of living crisis, Justin?
Well, I think basically it's 10 years of austerity. I think, I think working people have had their wages squeezed all across the last 10 years, possibly even back before that. And I think that has caught up with business and industry. I think they've realised they want to extract more profits from places. And as Martin was saying earlier on, they're just basically putting their prices up. It doesn't matter if it's oil or food. It just doesn't matter. They're putting their prices up because they want to make up for, you know, what happened in the last few years with the pandemic. And I think they've just seen it as an opportunity and the time's right. I agree with Martin that I think it's a false move, because the more you do that, the more people are going to rein in, the less they're going to spend. They're going to really try and, you know, look after what little they have got. And really, unless we can organise as the working class and mobilise and perhaps take a bit more strike action and really push employers into paying more, then I think it's going to be a really quite dire situation across the next half a decade.
Yeah, it could well be. And also, I mean, one of the problems with Dominic Raab and the Tories is they're not actually really producing much in the way of growth anymore. This is supposed to be what they're all about. And this is what the shareholders like Jacob Rees-Mogg and our very own Bristol Merchant Venturers rub their hands every time they see a nice share dividend. The growth is not doing very well. And I thought it was quite interesting the expression Dominic Raab used at PMQs. He said, "We're putting those growth policies in place." Well, that's interesting, isn't it? So he's kind of admitting that they're not actually growing anything at all. Well, what they're doing is they're trying to manoeuvre so they can start to grow the economy. Anyway, let's just have a listen, quick listen to this. It's only a couple of seconds, but it's, you know, it's the sort of thing that they slip in there, but it's easy, very easy to miss.
Look, I'll tell you what we're doing. We're putting in place the policies to grow our economy.
We're putting in place the policies to grow our economy, Martin. But is it working?
Well, you have to ask the question. You've only been in power for a decade, and you've only just decided you're going to put in place the policies to grow our economy. And in actual fact, as Justin pointed out, the policies they're pursuing, the problem with this inflation that we've got now isn't that it's going to be a wage price spiral, because it just doesn't work like that anymore. As it did in the 70s, what will happen is that people won't have the money, and then they won't spend the money, and the economy will crash. That's the most likely outcome. And of course, at that point, the Tories pretending that they're going to be, you know, that they've got the policies for growth. Across the whole world, there needs to be a massive public sector investment in the future as the basis for growth. The private sector simply isn't going to do it. And this is what they just think: if they deregulate, now we've got Brexit and all the rest of it, and entrepreneurs will grow up and invent new things like fintech and all the rest of it. And of course, a lot of this boosterism is associated with the idea that the digital economy is totally different from the previous economy, and this is the future and all the rest of it. And basic stuff is being missed here. I think the problem is going to be is that we're probably going to have a major recession, which may lose the Tories the election, but by that stage, the damage is done.
Martin, isn't there a sort of major problem here, a psychological one? Is that if the forecasters, like the Bank of England, start to say, oh, there's going to be a great rise in prices, all sorts of potential problems for businesses, they may not be successful, an increase in interest rates also could make it impossible for people to pay their mortgages. This is all signalling economic rocky world ahead of us. And that, of course, has an effect on people right now. They start thinking, well, I better not be spending. I better keep my money to myself just in case we have a bad year in the next couple of years. And that, of course, it can itself have an effect on the economy because people are saving rather than spending.
Yeah, I mean it's an expectations effect. You get into a liquidity trap, which is what happened after 2008, where nobody wants to spend. Everybody tries to save money. Because everybody's saving money means that the economy goes down the drain faster. The independence of the Bank of England has led to a situation where really there's groupthink there. When they see inflation, they reach immediately for the interest rates to try and smash it back down. You've got to recognise that a supply side inflation is not amenable to that. Yeah. You could raise interest rates in Britain, but it's not going to bring the price of oil down in the international market. And therefore, the inflation will carry on. But what you've actually done is you've crashed the economy. And that's exactly what happened in Osborne's era of being Chancellor. And of course, the only thing that stopped it was they eventually, without saying too much, stopped doing it. And really, we've got to, there should have been a huge rethink of the economics of how you manage countries after 2008. But it's still the same old small state, you know, leave it to the market nonsense, which needs to be absolutely obvious to everybody. That is just wrong.
No, it is. You're absolutely right. I mean, I can't help but think of the massive amount of government money that went in the 1930s to building these enormous council estates, for example. That was a way of just kick-starting the economy. It doesn't look as if there's anything like that on the horizon at all at the moment.
No. And I think we need a new vision of what we need to do. And, of course, obviously, the Corbynite Labour Party tried to present that vision, but it was too detailed and easily rubbish, because the common sense people have in their minds, a lot, you know, if you talk to people in the pub and say, oh, well, there's an economic crisis, oh, yes, well, they'll have to cut the civil service then, won't we? It's like, you feel like saying, why? And, of course, they haven't got an answer to that, because people are largely ignorant of economics. They don't study it. And it's made to sound as if it's more complicated than it is. I did a trade union course years ago, a CERTAS course, and of course it's basically a lot of what we were doing was taking people who've been active in the trade union movement and giving them and just giving them the tools to understand what's going on, because in actual fact it's not that complicated. It's made to sound more complicated. It's not for the likes of us and all the rest of it.
No sign of anything like this house building programme from the 1930s. I mean, the 1929 crash had a massive effect. Lots of people lost their jobs. The demand in the economy went right down. Martin, what would you do? Something simple like that if you were sitting in Rishi Sunak's...
The obvious thing is we've got a massive housing crisis. Is build some council houses.
Well, we can't have that, because that will bring the price of housing down, and all these people who have made an absolute fortune out of their house price rises will be very annoyed with you, Martin.
Well, the problem is that this is a political programme for buying Tory votes. So selling off the council house stock to the existing tenants at a fraction of what it turned out to be worth is basically just giving free money to potential future Tory voters. But it's not a rational economic policy. That's why productivity per hour in this country is lower than most of the rest of Northern Europe, because everybody's investing things like new conservatories, new garages. In Finland, they're building new businesses. We don't do that.
Yeah, well, you're right. Looking at there's this party of Chris Williamson, the former Labour MP for Derby, who was, he was a friend of Jeremy Corbyn until Jeremy Corbyn refused to support him. In fact, this is one of the reasons I think Corbyn had so many problems, was that he was treating his enemies in the Labour Party better than his friends, as well as his failure to back the Brexit vote at the last general election. But Chris Williamson has got this little party he has helped set up called Resist. It's a socialist party. It's part of the Trade Union Socialist Coalition. I think it already is part of that. It was going to be anyway. I spoke to him last week, and we had a clip last week, and I'll put the full interview up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later this evening, where this week we hear from Chris Williamson about what he would do if he was sitting in Rishi Sunak's shoes, because he's an absolute... I mean, maybe before we hear the clip, Martin, you can just comment on this, is to whether it is okay to spend much money, more money than you're getting in. What Chris is arguing is that because Britain is a sovereign country with its own currency, that actually we can spend pretty much as we want. Is that true?
It is, but there are limits, but we're a long way from any of those limits. And the way you control inflation is by negotiation. You use the wage bargaining system to control wage inflation, but you don't. But that means you still guarantee people's wages. You don't use it to drive down wages. And that's what, you know, in Scandinavia they call social partnership. Now, some people think that that's a bit wishy-washy, but in many ways, if it's done properly, it's a far more efficient way of doing things than we do in this country. Really is run by amateurs and crooks. You know, it's
Martin, they're not at all. They're running the country for their own personal private pocket.
Well, that's right. But of course, that ultimately that's actually dysfunctional for the functioning of the economy. Finland is a far more efficient country than Britain. Far more. Productivity per hour is higher, wages are higher, you know, everything's better managed.
Yeah, we've done
and
it enough.
Unions in Finland have a far more power than they do here.
We've done it over the last month or so. I've played several clips from the interview. I think it's Ben Norton's interview from the Multipolar World podcast with Michael Hudson, the US economist who teaches both at US and Chinese universities. His latest book, which explains a lot of the macroeconomics and what is really going on in the world, including the links to the dispute in Ukraine between the West and Russia, is called The Future of Civilization, Finance Capitalism, Industrial Capitalism, and or Socialism? Now, it sounds like a really exciting title, but the interview is about 50 minutes long. I chopped out loads of Ben Norton's overlong questions from it, and it really does explain, I think, what's going on in the world in economics. It's a way of kind of, it's a bit of a black art economics, and we get a lot of talk from the London press, from their finance correspondents, which is basically what the City of London wants them to be telling us, rather than any kind of independent thinking whatsoever. But someone who does a lot of that independent thinking we're going to hear from now, as I said, is Chris Williamson, with something which I've nicknamed his People's Great Reset.
I think we need a root and branch reform of the way in which the economy operates. One of the first things to do, of course, although it isn't kind of directly the Chancellor's responsibility, I would end the war in Ukraine. I would certainly stop sending arms to Ukraine, and I'd be using, you know, Britain's good offices, as it were, to you know, bring a resolution to that conflict, because that has actually generated the spike in energy bills, filled food bills, and could, you know, create shortages of both in the not too distant future if we're not careful. So that's one thing. But I think in more general terms, I would introduce a job guarantee scheme. So guarantee everybody, you know, a full employment economy, and that would be something that the government would step in and provide, so that where there was an issue of unemployment emerging, well, then the state could step in through a job guarantee initiative. I'd bring all of the utilities into public ownership, including the telecommunications and things like that, so that we are actually using the, which are, you know, by and large monopolies, many of them, for the public good, so that we're not actually wasting money on, you know, paying out dividends to shareholders. We're actually, you know, ensuring that we've got the resources in those various industries to provide much better service, better quality of services at a reduced price, as it were. I would be using the flexibilities at our disposal. I have a budget that actually is used to balance the economy, rather than saying that we, you know, we use the economy to balance the budget, as it were. Set goals, you know, mission-oriented budgeting. So we kind of set out, okay, what is it we want to do in this country? Well, okay, we want to create a good society. Well, how do we do that? Well, you know, full employment. Yeah, great. Let's reduce the pension age. Let's actually reduce the working week. Don't forget, John Maynard Keynes predicted in 1930 that his grandchildren, i.e. our generation, would only be working 15 hours a week because of the march of new technology, etc. Well, new technology, of course, has come. And I remember growing up in the 1960s and early 70s being told to get ready for the leisure generation, because by the time of the 1990s and early 2000s, we'd have lots more leisure time. Well, that's never come to pass. New technology has come on stream, certainly, but it's not been used for the benefit of the masses. It's been used to enrich the elites. And whilst it's true that new technology has accounted for a reduction in some of the jobs, that's true, but the biggest reason why we've seen a diminution in, you know, in some of those skilled manufacturing jobs that in the city that I used to have when I left school in 1972, around 120,000 people working in manufacturing. It's a fraction of that now. It's about 15 or 20,000 at most. But because many of the jobs have been offshored. They've been just, you know, in the globalized economy, so they've sent those jobs over to low wage economies, and so that's the sort of things I think I'd be looking to do, you know, use the power at our disposal for the benefit of the people, rather than, you know, as I keep saying, the benefit of the corporate elites. I mean, what we've got at the moment is socialism for the rich and penury for everybody else.
Okay, that's Chris Williamson, MP, former MP, not an MP anymore, I'm afraid. Who was shamefully, really, Jeremy Corbyn turned his back on him during the Corbyn era, and allowed him to be bullied by the Labour Party and removed from the Labour Party under false pretences. But anyway, what do you make of what you just heard, Justin?
I mean, I was just sitting there thinking, you know, what I would do, and I certainly agree that I think you do need a house building scheme. I totally understand that that's going to take away from the value of houses, but I think houses are somewhere where you live. You know, they're not something where you should be making a profit
from.
Well,
and also, of course, homes are massively overvalued. We've got an enormous great bubble. Yeah. At some point, that's going to go bang. Yeah. Yeah. You know, so wouldn't it be better to build slowly out of it so the prices come slowly down rather than for the whole thing to go bang and for people to be losing hundreds of thousands of pounds overnight?
That's certainly the way I see it, although I suppose, you know, there's speculators who are going to come in when the thing does go bang, and they're going to be sitting there with pots of cash, and they're going to be buying them up, and then they're going to be putting rents up, and everybody's going to be back in the situation they were in. But that's just
maybe they will time the crash in order to make sure that they can just be there ready with all those slush funds to buy up these distressed assets. I think this is what they do, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And then the other thing really is, I think you've got to put money in the pocket of working people. So I mean, I totally agree that you need to bring back the what we see as the essential industries into public hands. Absolutely, they should never have been sold off. And one thing that's interesting is I think that the government lost a lot of leverage over wages when they did sell them off. You know, they certainly don't have the leverage over pay that they would have had in the early 80s when they could control steelworkers, miners, dockers, you know, BT engineers, wages, everything like that. Now, really, they've only got the civil service to control, and that's why they're kind of picking on the civil service now. But that's just another thing. But yeah, put money in the pockets of working people, because as we all know, working people spend the money. Every single penny they've got, they pretty much have to spend. And that's what's going to, I think, save the economy. Oh, just one other thing is, I think it's really interesting about training and development. You know, that's something that's a real bugbear with our members. You know, people come to us and say, you know, we expect it to be developed, we expect it to be able to progress. There's a myth that's peddled in the civil service, much as in other industries, that if you just work hard and you can get on and you can get promoted and then everything will be all right, because it's like individualising pay. But we know that's not the case, because we live in pyramid structure. You can't all get to the top of pyramid. You know, it's like in the States. You can't all be president. You can't all be a millionaire, because if we were all millionaires, you know, there'd be no one to create that wealth, no one to sort of be predatory against. So it is a lie. It's a myth. What we need to do is flatten that pyramid out, you know, give more to less, so that we can have a fairer society. But we certainly need more training and development. And the UK is terrible for investment. The private sector don't invest. The public sector don't invest. They kind of expect us to turn up as sort of fully formed workers with all the skills we need. That's just not the case. And also, we're looking at universities now, and there's this big sort of, you know, kind of slagging off of the universities, saying that they're not training people for the workplace, and they're trying to cut back on the arts and things like that, because they're saying that people don't get productive jobs at the end of it. So I think certainly training and development is another area we do need to put money into. If we're going to have this skilled economy, we have to pay for it up front.
We've got a lot of people who, older people who've got these skills that they'd probably be delighted to pass them on to youngsters, wouldn't they?
Yeah, and it's like you say, it's having that opportunity in the workplace. I think people are so snowed under, so oppressed, you know. I mean, again, I was talking to one of our civil servants today, and he said that, I said one thing we tried to get rid of in the pandemic in the department that I'm, you know, looking after, was this sort of over-reporting thing. And he said to me, but I've got that now. And I said, well, we said to them, absolutely don't do that. He said, I produce a spreadsheet of what I've done, when I've done it, how many hours I've spent doing it. That goes to my boss, who checks it, and then their boss checks that as well. You know, that's the sort of example of how we could increase productivity. And I would say this as well, less meetings.
Well, I mean, you know, this is also smacks of a lack of trust. If you, you know, there's someone constantly, you know, looking over your shoulder, right, what were you doing on that stage, you know, maybe recording you, God knows what they, you know, of course, a lot of these calls, if you're working from home, are being recorded. But it just sounds to me as if there's been a bit of a breakdown in trust. Now, if that happens, then, of course, you've got a breakdown in morale too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, the last time I spoke to someone fairly high up in government, I ended by saying, your people need to feel valued, and that's exactly what they don't feel. You know, when civil servants are getting attacked with these threats of job cuts, when they haven't had a decent pay rise for pretty much 12 years now, when they're getting told with inflation running at like whatever it is, you know, double figures, that they're not getting anything like that, and the most that they can possibly get this year is 3%, then they're not going to feel valued, and they are going to try and look elsewhere. Because at the end of the day, the private sector might not always be the answer for every civil servant, but there are those who are going to be able to take some of their skills that they've developed on their own to the private sector, and you know, the private sector wage increases are running at more like 8% now. So that's going to look tempting, isn't it?
Well, look, the signal is obvious. Get out of the public sector into the private sector.
Is kind of what they want to do, and that's what they want to sort of engender. But also within, as I said a moment ago, within the public sector, it's still this thing of, well, if you were good enough, you could get yourself promoted and then you'd get more money. And that's the answer, you know, and it's clearly not. Not everybody can do that. Not everybody can leave the public sector. You know, I believe, you know, much in a sort of Keynesian way, that I think the public sector, this is a bit controversial maybe, actually supports the private sector. I don't think it's the other way around. Civil servants aren't a luxury because of the private sector. They make this country work. They are the nuts and bolts of this country. And on top of that, private business is allowed to flourish.
Back to Prime Minister's questions now, and Angela Rayner and Dominic Raab again, where she starts talking about the right to protest, amongst other things.
Well, well, Mr. Speaker, that says a lot about the party opposite. Yeah. I'll tell them a few things about militancy. It's this government that are acting in a militant way. Yeah. And while they should have been at the negotiating table, they were at the banqueting table getting hundreds of thousands squeezed out of their donors instead of dealing with a crisis. And he talks about trains. No one can get trains because of his failed transport minister, Mr. Speaker. And I tell you, he has a stronger stomach than his...
I think we'll just have a little quiet. I want to hear the question, and you'll also want to hear the answer.
Angela Rayner.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I think it's rather ironic that you have to intervene because of the baying mob here when they've got people through their noisy protest laws being stopped after protesting out on the street. The thing is, Mr. Speaker, they don't like it when the public say what they think of them. But I tell you, the honourable gentleman opposite has a stronger stomach than his colleagues behind him.
Honestly, I want to hear the question, I want to hear the answer. And I hate to say it, so do your constituents. Think about them for once instead of yourselves. Angela Rayner.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And when they were asked about the absent Prime Minister's plans to stick around until 2030, one honourable member opposite said he'd lost the plot. Another one said anyone with half a brain would realise how dire things are. Yeah. And a former Conservative leader said that the country would be better off under new leadership. Yeah. And now the Prime Minister is at war with his own Defence Secretary after confirming he will break his manifesto pledge in increasing defence spending. Under this government, Britain is set to have less troops, less planes and less ships. The only thing the Prime Minister's interested in is defending his own jobs. Just how many more troops have to lose their jobs before he finally says enough is enough?
Deputy Prime Minister.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. In fact, there's a £24 billion increase for armed forces. Spending on the armed forces is rising to 2.3% of GDP, again making us the largest military spender in Europe. And frankly, we'll take no lessons from the Right Honourable Lady when it comes to security of this country. First thing she did when she became an MP, 2016, voted against Trident, leaving us exposed. And she was campaigning for the Right Honourable Member for Islington North to be Prime Minister, someone who would take us out of NATO.
Yeah.
Mr. Speaker, talking about NATO, where was the Honourable Member when the situation in Afghanistan on a sun lounger? That's where the Honourable Member was. I take no lectures from the Honourable Member when it comes to doing your job.
Okay, but she seems to be quite good at coming back, Martin. Angela Rayner, I know you. You know, what do you make of her performance up against Dominic Raab, as against the usual? You know, with Boris versus Starmer.
Well, I mean, she's obviously a bit of a breath of fresh air. You know, she left school at 16 and all the rest of it. She's not part of the, you know, the traditional elite that runs the country. And of course, if you think back to the earlier clip, Dominic Raab was sneering at her for going to Glyndebourne to watch the opera, as if people like her aren't supposed to do stuff like that. And that's part of the problem with this country, is we have got a, you know, privately educated, Oxbridge educated, you know, moneyed elite that runs the country. And it's always been like that. It's not some new thing. It's just becoming more and more blatant as time goes on.
Justin, one of the things touched on there is this whole getting rid of the right to protest, the idea that if your union wants to have a rally, make some noise, anybody, in fact, it could be the nuclear disarmament people, this is now about to be restricted. So the police will swoop if anyone has a demonstration that hasn't been agreed to finish and end at a certain time or that gets a little bit too loud.
Just means we need more people on the streets, doesn't it? I mean, that's the way you get around that. You know, they've cut the police as much as they've cut anything else over the years, and they had that fantastic announcement a few years ago that they were going to recruit, what was it, another sort of 30,000 police officers. That was just to replace the ones that they cut about 12 years ago. So now I think the answer to that is that there's always got to be more of us than them, and, you know, that's exactly what the right to protest is about. That's exactly what strike action's about. It's when, for me, when the, you know, when the industrial workplace spills out into the community and you get that wonderful intersection of people finding out stuff that they never knew, you know, what actually goes on in there, and it gets workers talking to people on the streets, you know, and it brings other various groups together. So, yeah, I just think we just need more and more people on the streets, frankly. That's the answer.
The numbers aren't necessarily enough, are they? I can remember being in a Criminal Justice Act march back in, gosh, must be 1993, marching down, I think it was, Piccadilly, and then you turn right up the Mall, Park Lane, up along Park Lane.
Yeah.
And just as we're turning the corner, there was a whole load of toffs on the balcony, all sort of having drinks, chipping champagne, laughing at all the, you know, rabble mm-hmm. below. And some woman sticking two fingers up at the crowd. Actually, that is what they do, isn't it? So that we, you can have a march, you can have a rally, but at the end of the day, these people have the levers of power.
Yeah, they do, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've thought, you know, I was referring to what you do about the police if they're going to try and shut down a noisy demo. Do you know what I mean? If there's enough of you, well, they're not going to do that, are they? Yeah. But absolutely, they have the levers of power. But I mean, that comes kind of back down to education again, you know. And I think that's something as well that we have neglected on the left for probably 40 years. You know, I think it's a cause of Brexit, because there wasn't enough education about what the EU actually does and what the contribution was to this country. And I think there's a, you know, lack of education about refugees, about immigration. I think it's led to a lot of the racism problems that we have in this country, you know, still. And I think it leads to the basic lack of understanding about economics and the nature of power.
Well, let's just bring it down to Bristol for a minute. And one of the major, it's quite nice to see Bristol making it into the national press. And this is actually over the press itself. Bristol Mayor, the Press Gazette is telling us a couple of days ago, has sparked a press boycott, which has been joined by the BBC and ITV after his ban on local democracy reporters coming along to his weekly online press conferences. This week we did cover this last Friday, the beginnings of it anyway, and the South West Local Voice Network of Newspapers has also joined the boycott of the Mayor's press briefings. Though it's not a usual attendee of the briefings, the group said, as a publisher of hyperlocal publications, its titles rely on the local democracy reporters for information and also reach tens of thousands of Bristol homes each month. So now we've got ITV's regional newsroom in the Bristol area is boycotting the Mayor's press briefings. Ian Axton's head of news at ITV West Country said ITV News West Country stands by other media organisations on this issue. Justin, I don't know how familiar you are with this, but what's happened is the local democracy reporter, Alex, can't remember, Seabrook, I think his second name, is quite new to the job. And on one of his first questions to the mayor at these press briefings, it was about Mayor Marvin Rees flying to Vancouver and back to give a 17-minute TED talk about climate change. Now, he's saying, do you think that this is ironic that such a long flight was necessary? Couldn't you have done it on Zoom? What do you make of the subsequent banning of this reporter from the mayor's press briefings?
Yeah, I think, you know, you're a public figure. If you're going to do something like that, you've got to be able to account for it. And absolutely, the press have got the right to ask the questions. I think that's it's pretty extreme. You know, I mean, I've many years ago, had a little bit of interaction with Marvin. You know, we organised the protest against the EDL when they tried to come to town, and Marvin was great, and he spoke on the platform. He was kind of running for mayor then. That was before he was mayor. He was councillor at the time. You know, and I know that he was on the picket line the other day. So I mean, yeah, it's kind of it's complex. He can do some fantastic things, and then yeah, I think something like that is basically shutting down democracy, isn't it? It's shutting down accountability, and it shouldn't happen.
Well, we see these things far too much. That people are kind of it's almost a split personality. I mean, it's not just Marvin Rees by any means. When a politician gets elected, suddenly their principles all disappear. I was reading that it was Diane Abbott was tweeting last week that this is the last. I forget which policy it was, but it was the last of the 10 key policies that Keir Starmer was elected to be Labour leader to back has now been dropped by him. So, you know, being actually in the running for an election and actually, you know, being off, there's a basic lack of integrity. And I admire the press very much for what they've been doing here, particularly because we've got a bit of a problem with the press generally. And this week in the Press Gazette, it's a publication for journalists, but it's up there online, very easy to get. We used to get a newspaper once a week, or one thing, it was once a fortnight. It became once a fortnight. Now it's just an online service, but there's been a 5-year decline in UK news media trust, which is seeing the BBC, the Times and the Telegraph having the biggest drops, they report this week in the Press Gazette. The Times was named as the most trusted UK newspaper in 2018, but has since seen trust fall by 20 percentage points to 43%. I don't know exactly how you measure. I suppose it's just opinion polls with these things. And the data from the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism. Well, it's great to see Reuters actually being honest about, you know, some of their own journalism. The BBC also saw a 20% point drop in trust since 2018, though it's fall from 75 to 55%, still leaves it as the most trusted news in the UK, jointly with ITV News and just ahead of Channel 4 News at 54%. The BBC spokesperson said, although we're never complacent, our own independent research shows we saw a boost to perceptions of BBC News trustworthiness and impartiality. Now, what do you make of the press, both locally and nationally, Justin? Because it's something which, I mean, certainly in my lifetime, I think we've seen far less balance and rigorous journalism, both in the London media and locally. But maybe simply because there's less money around from advertising, as the internet has taken away advertising.
Yeah, I think certainly locally, I was aware of some stuff, some press that was being done by like People's Assembly and people like that last week in Bristol, and one of the people who was doing the press was stating that you basically have to write, you're not just writing your press release, but you're practically writing the article. And that's because of the demise of journalism, you know. It's because a lot of these local presses have just cut the journalists mercilessly, and they just basically become people who upload it onto a computer now. So I think that's the local picture. I think there's some good stuff out there still. You know, I listen to some stuff on Radio 4. I really like things like More or Less. I don't know whether you... I mean, yeah, it's got to be journalism, isn't it? But where they're really diving down into the statistics of things. You know, for example, they were talking about the rail strike, and they were, you know, debunking all these myths about how much rail workers get paid and how much difference there is between nurses and rail workers, for example. So, I mean, there is some good stuff out there, and I think the World Service, I'd always want to give a shout out to the World Service as well. I think they do a fantastic job, and I think it's really, really balanced.
Well, there's quite a lot of people that are bored stiff with a lot of what Radio 4 does, and they've switched over to the World Service. Now you can do. Of course, in the old days, you couldn't pick the World Service up. It was only on, I think it used to be on medium wave in London for a while, but it was mostly only on short wave, and you could pick it up in foreign countries. But it certainly seems to be more balanced. I mean, we've seen, for example, some superb programmes the BBC, I mean, I don't often say this, that the BBC have done, such as File on 4 recently, looking at a lot of privatisation, for example, privatisation of care homes, privatisation of the health service, and this sort of thing. So the Times has surpassed 400,000 digital subscribers, they say, this year. They did not respond to a request for comment. The Telegraph had 740,000 subscriptions across print and digital. So this is something that's happening increasingly, is that these, when they're going online, these daily newspapers, the London media, the main London media, are relying on people subscribing, so you can't actually read there. articles anymore, unless you switch off cookies. So if you go into your browser, folks, and you turn off cookies on that website, normally the article will appear, and it will say, would you like to submit? But at least you can read it.
Yeah.
Martin, what do you make of this this latest figure with the, you know, five-year decline in UK media trust, with the BBC, The Times and The Telegraph having the biggest drops in public support?
Well, I don't... the BBC, obviously, is a much bigger organisation than The Times and The Telegraph. It touches more people. And as Justin was saying, there's some stuff on the BBC is really good, but I think a lot of the political journalism is very much under the cosh from the Tories. You know, people like Koonsberg is clearly a Tory.
Well, she's gone now. Chris Mason is their political correspondent now.
Yeah, I know, but at the same time, you can see that they cravenly accept the government's narratives about things.
Well, I mean, I can remember Chris Mason. I had a little Twitter bish bash with Chris Mason a couple of years ago about him calling Jeremy Corbyn, or comparing Jeremy Corbyn to David Icke, things like that. I mean, that's the sort of person who's now political editor of the BBC. Martin? Martin seems to have disappeared there. So Justin, is anything we can do to get better news, better information? Because actually a lot of the youngsters don't read these mainstream media websites. They don't certainly watch the television. They get their news elsewhere, don't they?
I suppose it depends what you mean by better. You know, I mean, as you were just talking to Martin there, I was thinking, this is across the last 5 years, you're saying, about this demise in trust. And I was wondering if that actually sort of intersected with the rise of social media, and whether the fact that people can blog and vlog and stuff like that and perhaps attack what's going on the mainstream media, you know, more effectively than they could have done in the 70s and the 80s, for example. Mentioning the 80s, and I know we talked about Sherwood a bit, and we talked about the miners' strike and stuff like that. I mean, obviously, one of the classic things that happened was that reversal of the footage of Orgreave, you know, and that's, you know, one of the first that I'm aware of situations where there was just a blatant manipulation of the media. Yeah, I mean, things like that still go on. I mean, I curse sometimes when I hear some of the commentators talking. But again, I think you do have to balance that out with some of the better stuff that's out there. And again, you know, if you can choose your programs a bit more carefully, the ones that are a bit more analytical, then you are going to get the information you need that way. But social media, I don't know. I mean, I suppose it's that bubble thing, isn't it? That, you know, things like TikTok, you're going to watch the people that you like what they're saying. And, you know, and if they're saying stuff about the, you know, about the media or about social media or about what's going on in the news, then you're gonna listen to them, and if they're saying what you want to hear, then you're gonna keep watching them.
Well, I mean, one of the things I tend to do with social media is to look at particularly things I find particularly awful for people I disagree with, and then put a bit of a critique on it, so that you've got both sides. Because as far as I'm concerned, if you're trying to do any kind of journalistic activity and you've only got one side, well, I mean, that's becoming, in a weird way, it's becoming more justified when the mass media in London is only pushing one side. So, for example, with the Ukraine thing and how wonderful Zelensky is, how evil Putin is, like Hitler or whatever, coming from the London media, it's important to be able to put the other side. But to try and at least not insult the readers, listeners and viewers by pretending there is only one side. One of the big stories this week, well, I say it's a big story, maybe it's just a storm in a teacup, is Nicola Sturgeon announcing her quest, her bid for more Scottish independence and another referendum. Now, I don't know if she's going to get away with it. We'll hear what our guests think after we've heard Ian Blackford at the House of Commons at Prime Minister's Questions.
Mr. Speaker, Scotland's First Minister has set the date and started the campaign. Our nation will have its independence referendum on the 19th of October 2023. Scotland has already paid the price for not being independent. Westminster governments we did not vote for, imposing policies we don't support, breaking international law, dragging Scotland through a damaging Brexit we didn't vote for, and delivering deep austerity cuts. Contrast that with our European neighbours, who have greater income equality, lower poverty rates and higher productivity. Mr. Speaker, why not Scotland? In the weeks and months ahead, we will make the positive case for independence. Will the opposition, if they can, make the case for continued Westminster rule?
Deputy Prime Minister.
Can I thank the Honourable Gentleman? It's always good to see him in his place. It's good to see him in his place. It's not the right time for another referendum, given the challenges that we face as one United Kingdom. And I think, and he referred to some of the challenges in Scotland, but I think actually the people of Scotland want their two governments to work together, and we are keen, willing, enthusiastic to do so.
So the date proposed, which we didn't quite hear there, but is the 19th of October 2023. Well, you first, Martin Summers, speaking on the line. Can you, what do you think, is this referendum in 2023 next year going to happen in just over a year's time? Or will she get away with it? Or is it necessary? What do you make of it? I can hear a very quiet Martin. I think what we'll do is, whilst we're trying to get some sound from Martin, I'll let you answer, Justin, what you make of the Scots bid for independence.
Well, I think it's going to be interesting to see what the High Court decides on this one. Sorry, the Supreme Court decides on this one. My view is, I think they're going to struggle to even get that through that hurdle. I think. My gut feeling is that they'll rule it as being unlawful.
If there is a referendum next year, which way will the Scots vote? Do you think they've got the stomach to leave, really? I mean, I think, isn't it 1600 and something that the Scots joined up with the English?
The Union, yeah. I think it probably will go the way that Sturgeon wants it to go.
So what's changed since the last one? It's almost as if, you know, we want to have one of these, we want to have a regular one every decade until we get it. It's a bit like this, you know, we want to keep doing it until we get the right result, isn't it?
I know, and people will accuse the European Union of doing things like that, wouldn't they, in the past? But, I think something has changed. I think they've seen what Brexit's done. I think they've got that. I think you can look at what's going on between the mainland and Northern Ireland and stuff like that. Again, you know, when you're looking at austerity over here and, you know, suppressing the wages and inflation and things like that, and as Blackford said himself, you know, looking across, well, wouldn't you want to be part of something bigger and, some might say, better?
Well, they might. But they might not. And they might say, actually, what you need is you need control over your own policies, and you don't really want Brussels breathing down your neck, controlling your trade policy, your finance policy. At least it gives you a bit more flexibility. So, for example, keeping our own currency and not joining the euro.
Yeah. Certainly, I think if they went independent, they would have to look at joining the euro. I think that would probably be a condition of them going back into the EU if that's what they wanted to do. It's not exactly been plain sailing, has it, Brexit? It's not been what the people who voted for it were sold. The trade deals haven't materialised as everybody said they would.
Well, now hang on, because surely the opposite's true. It was supposed to be some sort of great disaster. Well, has it been a great disaster? It's surely, all the countries in Europe are putting up with the same sort of problems with the fuel price rises, the cost of living crisis as we are. It's not, we really, there hasn't been the sort of, great doom and gloom that was preached by so many before Brexit.
Yeah, I suppose you've got this ongoing issue between Northern Ireland and the mainland and where the border has to lie. And let's be honest, it's going to go somewhere. It's either going to go back between the Republic and Northern Ireland, or it's going to be in the middle of the Irish Sea. People in Europe are facing some of these problems as well, but I don't think they are facing them quite to the extent we are. And if they are, then I think their governments are doing something about it. I think there's something particularly malaise-ridden about the way that this administration deals with things, and I certainly don't think Brexit's helped them one little bit.
Now, Martin, are you back yet? No, can't hear anything from Martin. We'll just try and get Martin back for the next question. The next clip is about the Channel migrants. And this is another story which has caused an enormous amount of controversy, that we've still got people coming across the Channel illegally in these boats. But the question is, really, are they as asylum seekers, or are they simply economic migrants who are paying organised crime to get them into the UK?
Bel Ribeiro, Addy.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. In their efforts to pursue a hostile environment, the Home Office routinely tears families apart and breaks human rights and equalities legislation. They're reported to be sending up yet another charter deportation flight to Nigeria and Ghana. In Pride Month, they'll be deporting LGBT asylum seekers, fleeing homophobia, and mothers of British children who have lived in this country for over 25 years. Given that the Home Office repeatedly get it wrong and end up having to take people off these flights, can the Deputy Prime Minister tell me how many people have been removed from this flight already, and when will they stop these inhumane deportation charter flights?
Prime Minister.
Thank you, Honourable Lady. Look, she's right, at least in one respect. Of course, people who come here need to be treated decently and humanely. We're absolutely committed to that. We also need to make sure that we cut down the illegal routes, and those that are here that committed serious offences can be returned home. And the crucial thing, and I'm working with the Home Secretary, is to make sure we do both of those things. What we can't allow is illegal routes to flourish into this country, otherwise we'll just attract more. And we cannot allow people who commit serious offences in this country to stay and continue to pose a threat to the public.
Illegal routes. What do you make of this? It seems as if the government have been trying to do something about this and just completely failed. I'm not sure if it's deliberate or not.
Well, I mean, I think their voter base really wants them to do something about it. I mean, I'll put my colours out there because I think this is something that especially the Labour Party should have done back in 2015. I'm pro-immigration. I think that, you know, migrants and refugees should be welcome. And I think, frankly, we should be as anti-racist as possible. And I think that would have, you know, stood the Labour Party in good stead if they could have come out with those to be, you know, pro-EU, for example, back in 2015. That would have absolutely nailed the colours to the mast and nailed this issue. I think the issues is around criminality. And it just seems that, as many people have said, you're punishing the people who have already been punished, whether economically in their own countries or whether by war, you know, or by famine or disease. You're just punishing them again. They think they've got to a place of safety, and then you're basically sending them almost like right back where some of them have started, or to a part of the world that, you know, they really had no interest in going to in the first place, and perhaps is going to be detrimental to them, as Bill Ribeiro said, you know, in terms of LGBT rights, etc. So I think you deal with the criminals, you know, and all of the governments of Europe seem to be singularly failing to be able to deal with the criminals. I don't understand how people, you know, perhaps who don't even speak the language can find their way to these people, but the authorities who operate in that country can't deal with these problems.
Well, maybe the governments are the criminals.
You know, I mean, I certainly...
Well, they might be quite close to them, mightn't they? Yeah. I mean, the thing is, I mean, surely, you know, I can remember Bob Crowe from the RMT being very clear, saying it's not racist to say that we need to have legal migration. And also, he was quite concerned that the illegal migrants were undermining the pay and conditions of various people country.
You know, got a lot of time for Bob. I mean, he worked on the Central Line when he started, and, you know, and that's the part of the country where I was brought up. You know, he lived a mile away from where my mum lives. I went to his funeral just to stand on the road and pay my respects. You know, I don't agree with him on this one, you know.
Well, anyway, Justin Thomas from the PCS Union. Would you want to just tell us what is your actual sort of job description? Because it's I don't know if we would call you an apparatchik. No, because you're not from a political party, but you're a full-time union
worker. Certainly a full-time official. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Yeah.
So thanks very much for joining us. We will endeavour to revive Martin Summers, who seems to have disappeared, after the break.
As the choristers of Westminster Abbey process forward to be followed by the royal party, the opening hymn, Praise to the Lord, the Almighty, the King of Creation.
If I were a linesman, I would execute defenders who applauded my offsides.
They were due on the Crystal Maze, yeah, they were due to go on the Crystal Maze, yeah, they were due on the Crystal Maze, but they got mugged in Florida. They went up in a hot air balloon, they declared their love in a hot air balloon. Yeah, they drank champagne in a hot air balloon and had a row on New Year's Eve. They've got nothing but total respect for, they've got nothing but total respect for, they've got nothing but total respect for Annie Lennox. And if I'd have known they were coming, I'd have slashed me wrists.
So that's at the very end there, half man, half biscuit, and paintballs coming home. Now, the actual year of that, not entirely sure, would be somewhere around about the mid, early 1990s, maybe 1997-ish. Before that, you heard Hassani Sabah, which is from the Hawkwinds album from, I think, 1979. That is Quark, Strangeness and Charm. And the earliest of those songs is the Praise to the Lord, the Almighty. That's Commonwealth Day, recorded in Westminster Abbey on back in 2020. So welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, that was Justin Thomas from the PCS Union, talking about mainly, I suppose, these 90,000 threatened cuts to the civil service. Something like 20% of all the civil servants in the country apparently to be booted out. For those that want to bypass the psycho in the corner, that's us, with me, Tony Gosling, and Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Now, Martin, can you hear me?
I can hear you
better,
perfectly.
Yeah. So the mic's on now.
I can hear you perfectly.
Brilliant. Well, we can hear you, so the mic's on now, so it's all working. Right, so our first look in part two is it on the old international situation. Can you give us your just round up of how you think things are going with the Russian special military operation, or war as some people call it, in Ukraine? I noticed this week Biden is going to he's made a statement at the NATO summit. They seem to have NATO summits every couple of weeks now, to support Ukraine for as long as it takes, he says.
Well, I mean, they say that. And, of course, that's actually encouraging the regime in the Ukraine to take an ever harder line. Yet, at the same time, there are also straws in the wind that they really need a negotiated solution because it's all getting out of control. It's a very dangerous situation, probably as dangerous as the Cuban Missile Crisis. But most people haven't realised how dangerous it is.
I noticed also, because of the attack on the training camp in the west of Ukraine early on in the conflict, that there are certain reservations that the British have in actually training Ukrainian troops in Ukraine, that now Ukrainian troops are to receive their arms training in Britain, over here in Britain. It seems we're doing everything we can except directly engaging with the Russians. Hundreds of Ukrainian soldiers have received training inside Britain on how to use weapons provided by London, including the US-made M270 multiple rocket launcher system. The MRLS that Britain is sending Ukraine is said to have a range of about 50 miles, though they could potentially be outfitted with longer range munitions in the future. But the training has been taking place in Salisbury, southern England, for 450 troops from the Ukrainian army, Martin.
Well, obviously, by doing things like that, you make a negotiated solution less possible. And, of course, they're now trapped because of the extremity of the rhetoric. I mean, Boris Johnson told Zelensky that he should fight on until he'd liberated every centimetre of Ukrainian territory, supposedly, including the Crimea, which is absolutely unrealistic. And, therefore, they've trapped themselves into a situation where they can't back down without looking stupid. And, of course, they can't be allowed to look stupid, so they're not going to back down. The only positive thing I can see out of this is that the Russians have actually got quite a rational approach to what they're doing. They are winning, and there's no reason for them to change the formula. These Ukrainian soldiers that have been trained in Britain will go back to the Ukraine, and they will be killed, or they'll have to surrender. That's all that will happen. and it will just drag on for longer. Ultimately, the Russians are now in a position to, you know, it'll take a while because they're not rushing. They will take what they want in the Ukraine in terms of the areas that people basically are Russian-speaking, who want to be part of new political setup, and there's virtually nothing the West can do to stop this. Ultimately, this will cause a political crisis in the West, and it'll also cause a political crisis in the West because the sanctions on Russia have done nothing to damage Russia. They've done everything possible to damage the economy in the West, in Europe in particular. There's going to be a massive crash in Europe, not in Russia, in Europe. And at that point, there really will, because most people's support for this Ukraine adventure is actually quite shallow. And when you turn around to them and say, well, actually, it means you're going to lose your job, your house and your pension, suddenly people realise that it's all very well saying they're going to fight to the last Ukrainian, but are you going to give up your own welfare for a lost cause?
Well, we've had a NATO summit, as I said. They seem to be quite regular these days. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday this week in Madrid. I noticed on the first day of it, Martin, we had this attack on a shopping centre in Ukraine. Our army, though, it does not attack any civilian infrastructure. Putin angrily denies he blew up the Ukrainian shopping centre as a new video shows a Russian rocket, in inverted commas, destroying a block of flats while families slept inside, killing three people. So Putin has denied responsibility for a strike on a shopping centre which killed 18 people. The Russian president told reporters his forces did not attack civilian infrastructure, and it comes as a video showed a Russian missile strike a block of flats in Mykolaiv. So what do you make of this taking place on the first day of this NATO summit, Martin?
Well, if you look at the Moon of Alabama website, which has got a lot of detailed analysis of this particular incident, there is actually a massive factory right next to this, what is a shopping centre, but the shopping centre has been bankrupt since 2019. It's empty. So the people that have been killed are people who've been killed in the factory, and the factory is stuffed full of Western arms that have been supplied to the Ukraine. And the Russians are basically... They're trying to avoid civilian casualties, and of course, a lot of what's happened, the rocket attack on Kramatorsk railway station, that was clearly shown that was a Ukrainian rocket, and they deliberately killed Russian-speaking civilians so that they could turn around to the West and say, "Oh, the Russians are just killing people at random."
But now, Martin, this is not a Ukrainian rocket. This is a Russian missile on video.
Factory next door to the empty shopping centre, and the empty shopping centre then caught fire. But the people who've been killed are not civilians who were shopping in the shopping centre. The shopping centre went bankrupt in 2019. They were hitting the factory next door to it. Now, what the Ukrainians are doing with the advice of British Special Forces...
Just interrupt you a second.
They are deliberately Martin, lying about virtually
okay, well, some would say you may be deliberately lying because the Russian...
I'm not deliberately lying, Tony. I think there's a whole history of Western intelligence services deliberately trying to bend the narrative. The Bucha massacre.
Well, just a minute, but the headlines, Martin, the headlines Martin, the headlines on Euronews are Russian missiles hit a busy shopping centre. Doesn't sound like it was empty.
No, but Euronews is just recycling what the Ukrainian Ministry of Defence have told them. What they should be saying is Ukrainian Ministry of Defence are saying this, the Russians are saying that. And then people could make up their minds what was going on. But what's actually happening is that mainstream news in the West is simply recycling Ukrainian propaganda as if it were true. And there's no critical perspective being taken on any of this. And of course, as the war's progressed, it's quite clear that they've deliberately lied at every stage of the war. So, for example, they boasted that they created the Ghost of Kiev meme on social media of this brave Russian fighter pilot, Ukrainian fighter pilot, shooting down scores of Russian planes. And it was obvious that this was basically a computer game. But it was actually, this is what the Ukrainian SBU, with their British advisors and American advisors, were doing. They created this meme. And they even boasted about creating the meme. And they're saying, well, we create these memes in order to keep morale up. Now, anybody who's listening to what the Ukrainian Ministry of Defence says about anything has got to realise that they boast about lying. The Russian Ministry of Defence, on the other hand, is much more cagey. They don't say very much, but what they say, they can evidence. And ultimately, of course, the truth, it's very hard to know the truth of anything in these kind of situations, but the underlying facts on the ground is that the Russians are winning, the Ukrainians are losing, and the possibility of negotiation is disappearing because the Russians are winning so decisively that there's no need to negotiate with the other side. And that's before the end of the year, NATO is going to be comprehensively defeated in the Ukraine. And there's going to be a question why we're spending all this money on NATO when it don't do anything.
Well, they do. They do things. They do things like recruit new countries to join them, such as Finland and Sweden, Martin, this week.
Yes, and the Russians shrug their shoulders at that point because it's not going to make any difference to the military balance at all. The reality is that the Russians are, in their neighbourhood, are unbeatable, just as the US is unbeatable in its own neighbourhood. If you go to somebody else's neighbourhood and pick a fight with them, you're likely to lose. And this is the problem for the West. Scott Ritter is pretty clear on all this, the ex-UN weapons inspector and US Marine. NATO simply hasn't got the capacity to put sufficient forces into Eastern Europe to take on the Russians. They would never be able to do it. Just as the Russians haven't got the capacity to invade the United States from Mexico. These are geographical facts that can't be changed. If there's a war with Iran in Iran's neighbourhood, Iran will win because it's their neighbourhood. You're trying to take on people who've been there for hundreds of years, who've trained to fight you, who know what to do. You're going to lose. What's happened in the West is since 9/11 is they've got used to just invading places, bombing places like Raqqa in Syria and all the hospitals and wedding parties in Afghanistan and Iraq and all the rest of it. And we win, except we don't win. We lost in Afghanistan, we lost in Iraq, we lost in Libya, we lost in Syria, and we're going to lose in the Ukraine. And ultimately, that is what brings down ruling classes, like the Russian ruling class in 1905 and 1917. You lose your foreign wars, your credibility is ruined, and your economy is ruined, and then you're going to face revolution on your own streets. Nothing to do with the Russians. The Russians will just watch.
Well, it may be that they're trying to preempt that by the cost of living crisis and the sanctions basically immediately backfiring on the British people. The sanctions that are supposed to be sanctions on Russia end up being sanctions on us, domestic Brits. Anyway, Erdogan from Turkey is saying, Martin, that Sweden and Finland's NATO bids could still be blocked if the vows are not kept, he says. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said on Thursday that Sweden and Finland could still have their NATO bids blocked by Turkey if they don't follow a memorandum that was signed earlier in the week. Turkey lifted its objection to Sweden and Finland joining NATO after the three countries signed a 10-point agreement on Tuesday. Under the deal, the Nordic nations agreed to respond to Turkey's extradition requests, lift export controls on Turkey, and not to support Kurdish militant groups, according to the including the PKK. Erdogan says if the deal is not followed, Turkish parliament will block their membership. This business will not work if we don't pass this in our parliament, he said at the final day of the NATO summit in Madrid. So obviously there are some nice little deals here being cut, and the Turks are now smiling.
Not necessarily, because you may find that the PKK, which has been fighting against the Turkish government since the 1980s, and of course tens of thousands of people have died in that conflict, Diyarbakir, which is the capital of the Turkish Kurdistan, has been reduced to rubble. It looks every bit as bad and worse as what goes on in the Ukraine. And as you know, in Bristol, there's quite a strong pro-Kurdish militant sentiment amongst younger people. Some about like Anna Campbell, who went out and fought for the YPG in Syria. And in actual fact, what the Turkish government does within Turkey is in every way comparable to what's going on in the Ukraine. So it isn't just a war in the Ukraine, it's a war in the whole of the Middle East, a war in the whole of Europe, and all that's happening now is it's being escalated. So we won't just be watching shopping centres being bombed in Donetsk or wherever. We're going to be seeing from stuff, if the media was reporting honestly, we'd be seeing this stuff from inside Turkey. But of course, we don't see this stuff from inside Turkey because Turkey's part of NATO. But of course, the Americans tried to overthrow Erdogan, with the Fethullah Gulen movement, and the Turks want loads of those people to be extradited, and pro-Kurdish militants to be extradited, to be executed in Turkey.
Well, that's, now, I mean...
What you're going to find is that this is just another escalation. That's
well,
all it is.
The US did actually attempt to conduct a coup in Turkey against Erdogan,
they didn't.
They?
They did, and in actual fact, it's only because of the intervention of the Russian FSB that he wasn't assassinated. The Russians are pretty annoyed with the Turks because they've done quite a lot to try and, you know, keep them sweet, as it were. But the Turks are always, you know, basically double-crossing them. But ultimately, this means that this war isn't just about the Ukraine. It's actually a global struggle now between the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which was meeting, and the BRICS Plus, which was meeting in Beijing at the same time as the G7 was meeting in Bavaria. But it's pretty clear who's going to win. And it isn't the old powers. New powers are coming forward now. India is not going to sanction Russia, nor is Mexico, nor is any of the big countries in Latin America. So all that happens now is that Western Europe and Eastern Europe is sanctioning itself to keep the Americans happy, but it's not effective. But the rest of the world is moving on. It's the collapse of global Western power. After 500 years, it's a big turning point.
Well, it's not necessarily a collapse. I mean, we've seen this week the Ukraine cutting diplomatic ties with Syria. I'm not sure how significant those ties have been, but the Syrians have recognised the separatist republics of Donetsk and Lugansk this week, Martin. So Syria has become the first country other than Russia to recognise these separatist republics.
Well, that wouldn't be at all surprising. As the Syrians and the Russians have been and Hezbollah and the Iranians have been fighting our attempts to overthrow the democratically elected government of Syria. There was a democratic election. We just didn't recognise it. And, of course, war has been raging on our planet ever since 9/11. And now suddenly people have woken up to the fact that it's arrived in Europe. But people have been dying every day since that tragic event. And, of course, what's ultimately going to happen is the people in the West are going to start suffering in the way that they've inflicted on everybody else, and they ain't going to like it.
Lugansk, the Russians are saying it's almost completely been, as they put it, liberated now from the Ukrainian army occupation. That's one of the two, these two breakaway republics. I think it's fair to say that there's a bit further for the Russians to go in Donetsk. So how significant is it that Lugansk is now almost entirely in Russian hands? The last major obstacle was this city, Severodonetsk, which now apparently is entirely in Russian hands.
Well, there's going to be a change. You know, Ukraine is going to be partitioned, as Yugoslavia was partitioned by NATO in the 1990s. There's no way that the Ukrainians, even with full heart, even if NATO intervened with all of its forces, they couldn't change the situation. There's no realism in the Western political elites. People like Liz Truss and others talking about we're going to fight on forever until we get, you know, we don't even count the cost when it's a matter of principle. Well, it's a matter of principle for the Kurds to have an independent state in Turkey. It's a matter of principle for the Nagorno-Karabakh people not to be part of Azerbaijan. It's a matter of principle that people in Kashmir don't want to be part of India. It's a matter of principle. There's matters of principle all over the world, and people are dying for those matters of principle. And if people in this country really want to go down that road, then they can go down that road, but they will find that they will be dying too if they carry on the way they're going.
So the last town left in Lugansk that the Ukrainian army still just about control is Lyschansk. That's, you know, the last one we'll probably be hearing in the next few days or weeks that's fallen. What about the other breakaway republic of Donetsk, Martin, though? Because this may be a tougher nut to crack, and it may be the end of the year, do you think? Can you give us an idea of how long you think it'll take?
It's silly to try and speculate how long it's going to take. I'll say this, the Russians aren't in a rush. There's no rush, and they were saying they're losing. They thought they were going to win in 3 days. It's quite clear that what they're doing, they didn't plan to win in 3 days. And the reason it's taking so long as it took so long in Syria is they're not just flattening everything. When the Americans go into a place, they just flatten everything, kill everybody, like in Fallujah, like in Raqqa. That's what they do. But the Russians aren't doing that. They're basically killing the military opposition they face They're trying to get them to surrender if possible, and they're trying to minimise damage to the civilian infrastructure and civilians, because they want to take it over. You know, they don't want to smash the place up. They want to run it. And that's going to take a while. And in Syria...
Well, that's not happening, Martin.
Various pockets.
That's not happening...
And then negotiate with them to try and get them out without a fight.
What you're saying
that's
is...
the way you do it.
What you're saying is not happening in Mykolaiv, is it, on Wednesday, when the shopping centre was hit?
No, well, which shopping centre were we talking about? The one that was by the factory? Or Mykolaiv is down towards Odessa, so that's a different shopping centre.
Mykolaiv, it's called.
In Odessa... is they're saying that they've hit various, apartment blocks and so on. Now, there's evidence to suggest that the Ukrainians, especially in the East Ukraine, where you've got largely Russian-speaking population, and that's what happened at Kramatorsk railway station, because there's a picture of the Tochka-U missile, which must have been a Ukrainian missile, because the Russians don't use those missiles. They deliberately kill Russian-speaking civilians, blame the Russians, and, of course, they're being advised to do this by British military psychological warfare officers. And don't forget NATO, with Gladio and all the rest of it, the people who are long listeners to this programme will know all about the history of that. They've been manipulating Western public opinion through the use of terrorism for decades, and they're doing it now. The problem is that when you're fighting a truly formidable enemy like the Russian state, you're not going to win just by telling lies and killing people in false flag attacks.
Okay, but the UK, Martin,
isn't decided by
the UK Foreign Secretary Liz Truss at the NATO summit said that NATO needed to ensure a Russian invasion of a sovereign nation could not be repeated.
Well, she can say that, but there's nothing they can do about it. There's nothing they can do about it. They can huff and they can puff. The fact is that as far as the Russians are concerned, Donetsk and Luhansk voted 80% plus to secede from the Ukraine. And they could have taken it at that time. They chose not to because they thought, let's negotiate. Let's not fight to the finish. Let's negotiate. But if the West doesn't want to negotiate, then the Russians just say, fine, don't negotiate with us. We're just going to take what the people here want us to do. There's massive support for this inside Russia. They get a completely different version of events from the one we're getting. And you say, well, that's a load of lies in Russia. What makes you presume it's a load of truth on our side of the fence? What we ought to be hearing is both sides putting their case, and we should be interrogating who's winning and who's losing. But we're not. We're being fed a load of war propaganda by our own side. But ultimately, of course, it's a war propaganda for a war we cannot possibly win. And the longer we carry on fighting it, the bigger the defeat is going to be. And eventually, of course, that's going to be decisive in the West. There's going to be a change of political leadership. Other people are going to come forward in places like Germany and say, look, this is madness. We can't go on like this. But first of all, people have got to suffer. Because at the moment, they're still under the impression this is all happening on the television, it won't affect them. When the winter comes in Germany and people are put on rationing and the heating is cut and they lose their jobs, they'll suddenly realise what's at stake. And do they really want their whole economy and society ruined for a lost cause? They can't win.
Well, NATO seems...
If you're going to go to war with people, you've got to have a plan to win. It's not just saying, I want to fight. The question is, how can you win? And I think that's the problem with an awful... The West has just got to presume that they have got military superiority. That's gone. They had military superiority over Saddam Hussein. They had military superiority over Gaddafi. They didn't have military superiority over Syria. And they haven't got military superiority over Russia.
No, it seems
and you don't pick fights with people you can't beat.
It seems pretty clear to me that NATO want to widen this conflict, if at all possible. How do you think they might do that in the future?
Well, what's the danger here is that all of these conflicts across the Middle East and into the Central
Asia...
Well,
I'm talking specifically about in Ukraine, because the Russians seem to be pursuing their goals to take these two breakaway republics off the hands of Zelensky and the Ukrainian army, and they may well achieve that by the end of the year. Surely there's a limited time in which if the NATO wants to... escalate this crisis, that they're going to have to intervene and do something to make to actually draw more NATO countries at higher levels into this fight, because the Ukrainian army can't do it on their own.
Well, even if NATO was to mobilise all of its resources and declare war on Russia, they would be beaten, and that's one of the reasons why they haven't done it. It's just idiotic. just as if Russia and Mexico were to decide we're going to invade the United States, they would be beaten. So there's no point setting yourself unrealistic goals. Realpolitik isn't just about power politics, that's Machtpolitik. Realpolitik means facing the fact the majority of people in Luhansk and Donetsk voted 80% plus to secede from the Ukraine. The majority of the people in Kurdistan in Turkey don't want to be part of Turkey. Syria wants the Golan Heights back. They don't belong to Israel. The people in Palestine do not accept the existence of the Israeli state. It's an illegitimate state. And therefore, war takes place. What could ultimately happen, of course, is that the Russian army with the Syrian army could drive the Israelis back to the Green Line of 1948. And if the Israelis didn't like that, they could always go back to where they came from in the first place, the citizens who didn't want to live in that smaller state, which, of course, would also be economically ruined. Now, none of this is rational. We should actually be talking as a small, as a species, about solving all of the problems we've got in the economy, in the environment, and all the rest of it. But if war is war, and if it is, the thing about the West is that they like wars in other people's countries, and they think they can always win, and that's a delusion. That's over. That era is finished. The Russians and the Chinese and their allies in the developing world, South Africa, Brazil, Argentina, India. India is now sitting on the fence, but they're definitely not joining the West on this. Pakistan isn't joining the West on this. Ultimately, the West is going to be isolated, and that means the end of the Western system, including the oligarchs that run that system. And that's possibly not a bad thing, but it's a shame that we've had to have all of this bloodshed to do what should have been done through peaceful democratic change.
The shopping centre was hit in the city is Kremenchuk, is the name of the city. Right. K-R-E-M-E-N.
There's actually a great big factory right next to it which produces arms. That's the target.
E-M-E-N-C-H-U-K. I'm a little bit suspicious about this happening, you know, quite conveniently for this NATO summit. And whenever I see NATO summits meeting, I'm also looking for, is there a great big news story which will kind of justify what they're sitting around planning and doing? Do you think it's feasible to drum up an attack like this? Maybe it's even an attack from your own side in order to...
Well, the Kramatorsk railway station, it clearly was a Ukrainian missile that were deliberately targeting civilians. And, of course, it's not made clear in the Western media that the Ukrainian army in Donetsk has just been shelling indiscriminately the civilian areas on the other side of the line. The Russians are trying to avoid civilian casualties, but hey, you can't avoid all civilian casualties in war. Lots of civilians have been killed in Syria. That Syrian army isn't trying to kill them, but if you've got jihadists who are holding them hostage, and the Ukrainians, with advice from the Western psychological warfare operators, the Azov battalion in Mariupol were using the local civilian population as human shields, and the Russians were opening up corridors for people to get out, and as people tried to get out, they were shooting them. It's exactly the same tactics pursued in Syria, and therefore this is actually NATO standard tactics. And at the same time, you have a little violin playing, and you're trying to tug at the heartstrings of well-meaning people in the West that the evil Russians are raping, murdering, killing, you know, indiscriminate. They just do it for the hell of it, and it's absolutely disgusting because, of course, the 9/11 attack wasn't carried out by Muslim extremists. It was carried out by the Western security services, but they then used as an excuse to invade all these countries and kill millions of people. That's the kind of people they are. The evidence has been mounting for years and years and years and years and years. Why do you think that in the Ukraine they're not using the same tactics? Of course they are.
Martin, we're going to hear now from Dr. Naomi Wolf. I remember there was a little Twitter spat between her and Naomi Klein about 3 or 4 months ago, where Naomi Klein was being a little bit mean about Naomi Wolf, saying, oh, well, she's not really the real Naomi. Well, I think she is, and I think she's actually far more articulate, although Naomi Klein seems to have much more money and much more publicity behind her and her excellent theories to do largely with The shock doctrine is one of her most important ones. Anyway, lots of things that she's come up with. Anyway, so let's have a listen now to Dr. Naomi Wolf talking on the Mark Steyn show. This is on GB News regularly. I think Mark is doing actually a brilliant job. It's the sort of show that, you know, this is kind of, you know, if we had all the resources, we would be doing this kind of stuff, I guess, for a national audience. And Mark is on, I think it's twice a week, on a Tuesday and a Thursday, on GB News. Mid-evening time, where they talk about this sort of thing that Martin has just been telling us about. We're not hearing generally on the London media at all, this whole background of NATO intelligence services blowing up their own people and blaming it on whoever it is that happens to be the enemy at the time, whether it's the Soviet Union back in the old days, or whether it's the Islamists, the Muslims in more recent times, where this whole idea of online censorship is now starting to come along, because we've got something called the Online Safety Bill chugging through Parliament, going to become law fairly soon, where lots of groups, like even potentially this programme, could be considered a crime to be publishing what we're publishing, which is pretty shocking. So here's Dr. Naomi Wolf talking to Mark Steyn, Steyn, Mark Steyn, a couple of weeks ago.
I spent, you know, a number of years in Great Britain, and I always cherished its innovation, you know, to humanity on issues of freedom of speech and personal liberty. And it's tragic. I mean, what a shock that Ofcom is going to partner with this, you know, this tech bro funded full fact entity. That is yet another blow against the great British tradition of freedom of speech. And it's horrible. I'll answer that. But just, I want to validate your point about internet censorship. My book, The Bodies of Others, follows the money. And we found, of course, that millions of dollars went, that these tech companies are invested in the lockdowns and the vaccines on every side of this debacle. Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation flowed millions of dollars to a lot of British legacy media. I'm free to say this on your show. No one I usually write for or speak for, you know, from The Guardian to the BBC, is asking me to say it on their show, because they took the money, or on their site, they took the money. Millions went for vaccine education or COVID education from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. That means they can't cover the harms, the catastrophic harms emerging from the worst public health mistake ever made in our era, which is the rollout of these vaccines. Bill Gates, of course, it owns a chunk of Microsoft, which makes the vaccine passports. Salesforce makes the vaccine passports. Google owns Baseline, which is where you sign in when you get a COVID test in a big chain of American drugstores. And over and over again, you see these COVID dashboards, including your own Office of National Statistics dashboard, hiding the data sets, or partnering with third parties that are also invested, like Bloomberg, you know, through the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg Health Foundation, to benefit from the vaccines and from the lockdowns. And lastly, you know, tech companies also benefit, like even Amazon and Zoom, and again, Google, they're up 20 to 25% after 2 years in which they were instrumental in lobbying for policies and messaging dangers, right? And inflating dangers that led to lockdowns, lockdowns of high streets and main streets. So Amazon got to crush their competition. They're up literally 20 to 25% net revenue. Your child couldn't go to in-person school in many countries. You know, no in-person worship, no in-person shopping, no in-person restaurants or bars. So you're driven onto digital platforms. And not only do you have to do all your commerce then on digital platforms, you know, fattening the coffers of these entities, but also, I'm CEO of a tech company. Every minute you're on a digital platform, your data or your attention are being monetized and harvested. So you know, the argument of the Bodies of Others was these policies, they don't make sense medically, but they make sense to recreate our world so that all of our social life is redirected onto a medium that they can control. And also, you know, it's an echo effect where they amplify, as your previous guest said, the fears, you know, wrongly. They report the data wrongly. I had a back and forth that was fascinating with the guy who built the Office of National Statistics dashboard, where he conceded that, you know, they were lying, basically, and using bad data, or holding the data so that there would be a spike after a holiday, which is ridiculous because it's a machine doing the counting, right? But they also get to, as you're seeing, police, people like me, people like, you know, Dr. McCullough, Dr. Malone, mm-hmm. the dissident doctors in your country that I no doubt have never heard of because I'm dependent on Google to tell me, you know, to make sure that we don't get hurt and people are alone with their suffering. And going to the harms, shall I launch in with the harms that we're, you know, that they didn't tell you about with these vaccines? Because it is absolutely catastrophic.
Yes, the harms they didn't tell you about with the vaccine. So at this time, particularly with the censorship that there's been over COVID, it seems absolutely appalling to be further restricting what people are allowed to say in the media, Martin. So are you joining us? Can you hear okay?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes, I certainly can. Yes, it's nice to hear you back again. You were a little bit sort of gravelly and crispy sounding just now. Now you're back to your normal warm self. But this online safety bill seems to be almost be brought in by the Conservative government to literally restrict freedom of speech. It was called the Online Harms Bill. It was touted as something which is going to protect people from being harangued by internet trolls and this sort of thing, but actually it could criminalize the sort of things we talk about, Martin.
Yeah, I mean, we can have different views about any of these topics, but then you know that, having them decide what we can and can't say, totally unacceptable.
Well, there
they
is a,
not, you know, they shouldn't be doing that.
There is a very basic law fact which should be used when it comes to freedom of speech, and that is that if you can say what you want so long as you're not inciting a criminal offence. And if you're inciting a criminal offence, I can quite understand why someone would say, well, you know, you shouldn't be doing that, and that would be a very irresponsible media that would be going around doing that. And I suppose we're getting to the crazy situation where, you know, you and I might advertise a demonstration that was happening here in Bristol, and that demonstration was to break the law, these new demonstration laws that Priti Patel wants to bring in, and vicariously we could be then criminalised for encouraging people to break the law. But we certainly don't need internet censorship, and that's, you know, what I've just said is nothing to do with that. Lord Frost this week has warned in the Daily Mail that this flawed bill to clean up the internet must be changed amid fears that it could be highly damaging to freedom of speech. It will outlaw comments on social media that would be legal in the real world. Circulating fake news will lead to get material wiped if it is classified as intentionally false. Now, you know, you and I know we've been thrashing through this plandemic for the last couple of years, that actually what the fact checkers have been saying is nonsense. And what Naomi Klein was saying there is that often these fact checkers are simply working for a lobby of some sort, and their purpose is to take down the people who are opposing their lobby, like you and I.
Well, that's right. And I think there's a broad spectrum of political views opposed to censorship of the internet. And you've got what you might call the controllers, who want to control the narrative, who don't want to hear things that they don't want to hear. But that's, in a sense, 'twas ever thus. We're still struggling. You know, the powerless have always found it difficult to get a voice, whatever the technology level. And, you know, these struggles go on.
And it's not just you and I bellyaching about this. It's also the Institute for Economic Affairs says the bill raises significant issues of freedom of speech. An unsafe bill has been published by the Institute of Economic Affairs and outlined its impact on free speech, privacy and innovation. The report found a lack of evidence to justify the legislation with respect to both the alleged prevalence of what the bill treats as harm and the link between the proposed measures and the desired objectives. The bill gives strong incentives for social media companies to restrict content which they say is legal but harmful to adults, and empowers government ministers to decide what this covers. Now, this is starting to get a little bit like Priti Patel and her anti-gypsy bill, anti-traveller bill, which is now law, the Police Crime Courts and Evidence Bill Act now, where the police were saying, actually, there's no need for this bill. We don't actually want it or need it. And yet she did it anyway. So the similar sort of thing is happening with this online safety bill.
Well, that's true. And of course, you know, David Frost and the Institute of Economic Affairs, they want to, to have their freedom to push their particular right-wing ideology, and they fear that the tech companies will censor them. But of course, it's equally the case that people like Jeremy Corbyn could be saying, well, I don't want to be censored either. So we've got to separate out what the issues are, whether it's to do with vaccines, wars or whatever, because there's bound to be different views about that, and the right to people to say what they want and get information. Now, I think that when you've got, you know, we should in fact be trying to get a culture of fact checking going, not just by governments, but by people. You know, don't believe everything you hear. Check it. The internet is a fantastic tool. Check things. Don't just take it for granted that this, you know, the Ukrainian government says a shopping centre has been hit and so many people have been killed. Well, don't necessarily take their word for it. What are other people saying? What are the facts? And there's an, you know, because we're moving into a potentially world war situation, you can see how quickly it could be the case that the powers that be in the West will say, well, it's a war situation now, so we're going to have to shut you up because we've got to win the war.
Well, the other
and
thing,
we
Martin,
can't possibly tell you that we're losing.
Which we haven't even touched on yet, is that these big tech companies could be fined up to 10% of their annual profits for letting someone say something the government doesn't want them to say, which is a pretty sharp way of making sure that your Facebooks and the rest of them do censor content as much as, you know, as the government wants them to.
Don't forget that the internet companies themselves, the Facebooks and Googles and so on, have got their own interests. They don't want lots of criticism of Google and Facebook. And if the government and they get together, I mean, what's happening is that censorship is being outsourced to these ostensibly private companies who have massive government contracts.
Well, yes, so they also will allow the taking out of or fining of ordinary internet service providers too. But yeah, well, Mark Steyn's been doing a great job. We just heard from him with Dr. Naomi Wolf a minute ago, but he also has a way of getting these models and people who are sort of have a bit more of a sort of celebrity status. And here is Leilani Dowding, who is also criticising the online safety bill on the Mark Steyn show on GB News.
Virginia Lamb, who was on this show yesterday, who's got Guillain-Barré syndrome, and she spent the first year basically thinking she caught this from the vaccines, and she thought she was all alone. Because if you go on the internet to see if anyone else is talking about that, they've all been blocked and cancelled and shut down by Twitter and Facebook and Google. Only one side gets shut down.
Absolutely. And I had a plumber over my house today. Sorry, a tiler. He was doing the bathroom. He told me that after his second or third jab, he got Bell's palsy within a couple of days. So, you know, it's happening. It's out there. But as you said, there's only one side that's allowed to put their side across. So these aren't, and it's not fact checkers, they're against the narrative checkers. They're opinion censors. They're not fact checkers because these aren't facts. You know, it's come out now that, you know, you couldn't say that there's a possibility that the COVID came from Wuhan, but, you know, it's more than likely that happened. It came out, out of Wuhan University. It's more than likely that was the case. But, you know, they haven't corrected anything. You've still got misinformation banners there. People were still censored. And it's not just the likes of me. It's cardiologists, epidemiologists, lawyers like Robert F. Kennedy. They've all been censored. And the thing is you've got these fact checkers that are supported and funded by Soros, Facebook, Google. You've got all of them. And now they're trying to lobby the government to pass and put medical disinformation into the online harms bill. So that's going to mean that maybe I wouldn't just get censored, I'd actually get fined, or it would be seen as criminal for me to have said what I've said that now comes out to be true.
Well, that's the lovely Leilani Dowding there. And it's great to see, the range of guests that Mark gets on that program. Fantastic. I mean, there's all sorts coming out about what's been going on. I mean, for example, Nature, which is a big magazine over in the United States, is saying That age and sex specific risks of myocarditis and pericarditis following the COVID-19 mRNA vaccines are a worry. Cases of myocarditis and pericarditis are reported following the receipt of these mRNA vaccines. These are basically heart problems with your heart muscles. Vaccination campaigns are still to be extended. We aim to provide a comprehensive assessment of the association by vaccine and across age groups and sex groups using nationwide hospital discharge and vaccine data, analysing 1,612 cases of myocarditis and 1,613 cases of pericarditis that occurred in France from May the 12th, 2021 to October the 31st, 2021. And they find actually a horrific number of these cases, Martin. And this isn't really finding its way, occasionally finds its way into the mainstream. But what we're being told, I mean, if you're putting out information saying that the vaccines could give you a heart attack, Facebook, Twitter, and the rest of them are the people, and YouTube, of course, are the people who are likely to ban you for saying that. And yet here we have now evidence that it's true. This is, I suppose, a bit of a slippery slope, isn't it? So that, for example, fact check SARS-CoV-2 has been isolated. Well, no, it hasn't been isolated. Or has it? Has it been isolated? These are the sorts of questions which, if you start to ask them online, you can be banned, Martin. And now, potentially, as she's saying, they're fined.
Well, I'm against censorship of any kind, really. That doesn't mean that if you give everybody the right to say what they think, it doesn't mean that everybody's right. Because in actual fact, people disagree. And that's the whole point, isn't it? They're going to disagree about this. I mean, all of these people going on about mRNA vaccines, I'm willing to listen to all of that. I think COVID itself is a biological warfare agent. It's an attack on China to try and take China out of the global system before they become the world's biggest economy. And we're actually at war. And that's therefore, of course, censorship has always traditionally been part of wars. And we're in a war, and censorship is part of war. So if we're going to fight censorship, we're also going to recognise the warlike nature of the situation we're in.
I mean, I'm going to put a link up to the Institute for Economic Affairs report. I think it's an absolutely brilliant job they've done here, pulling the whole of this online safety bill, which is actually really a censorship bill, apart, which Nadine Dorries is championing, the Culture Secretary. The briefing also warns the bill's free speech protections appear wholly inadequate, with the risk that those claiming distress will request the removal of speech just simply because they disagree with it. So I can say, oh, I find this offensive, Martin, and it will be removed, even though it's just because I disagree with it. I've reported it. Writing in the Times, the co-author Martin Lesh called the bill a recipe for automated over-removal of speech on an industrial scale to ensure compliance and placate the most easily offended. And also, of course, this includes these massive pharmaceutical lobbies, etc. So this is another aspect to all of this, which I haven't even mentioned, really, is that this is going to be done largely by algorithms with no human being involved whatsoever.
Apart from the people who design the algorithm. I mean, the censorship is obviously wrong, but that doesn't mean that we didn't have censorship before all this stuff kicked in. It's always, as I said earlier, it's always been difficult for the marginalised and others to get their voice heard. If you remember back in the 1980s, Sinn Féin couldn't appear on British TVs, so they had to have voiceovers from them making their statements about what was going on. Totally stupid, didn't achieve anything, just reminded everybody who was sympathetic to them that in actual fact they lived in a repressive society and that probably they were justified in taking the actions they took. So as Justin was saying earlier, the answer to all of this kind of trying to repress demonstrations and silence people is get on the streets and shout louder.
There's also in the IEA report, they're saying that the bill's Byzantine, and I quote, Byzantine requirements impose large regulatory costs on startups and smaller companies, will make it riskier to host content and develop innovative services. This could discourage investment and cement the market position of the big tech companies who can afford to comply with it. This is the usual, isn't it? This is just a massive bureaucracy that's being imposed on anybody that provides services online.
Well, what it is creating barriers to entry. Yeah. That's what most advertising does. It just creates a barrier to entry. If you want to sell fizzy sugar water, you've got to compete against Coca-Cola, who's got an advertising budget in the billions. And that just means that you've got to have an advertising budget in the billions in order to compete with them. Although what's obviously happened in Russia with Coca-Cola and McDonald's withdrawing from the Russian market is all of their assets have been taken over by Russian entrepreneurs, rebranded, and that market is now gone to those Western companies, and they're never going to get it back.
Well, I'm sad to announce the death of Dr. Vladimir Zelenko. He died this week. He was one of Donald Trump's doctors, and he was very outspoken Jewish doctor about the jabs, and also he was a biblical Jewish doctor. He did an amazing job, really. He called it the poison death jab, basically, and he was very articulate as someone that knew how to cure people and knew people's immune systems very, very well in explaining the dangers. And of course, he was censored many times, but he's out there, but he's not, I'm afraid, out there anymore. He's passed away. Goodness knows, maybe we'll be seeing him again one day. The destruction of the United States of America was included in the... I'll put a link up to our show page at thisweek.org.uk to one of the last interviews that he did. In fact, I think it's the last interview he did before he died. And that was looking at the destruction of the United States of America as part of the whole COVID business and how that has contributed to one of the world's great superpowers crumbling.
How do you take the most powerful economy and military in history and in a few years undermine its superpower status? I'll tell you how to do it. You create a false pandemic. You have policies that lead to financial destruction. You lock down the economy for no good reason. More than a million small businesses went out bankrupt. I couldn't go to my local grocery store, but I could go to Walmart because that was safe.
Right.
And so what happened was the market share of a million small businesses got absorbed and gobbled up by the bigger businesses. If you look at their valuations, they in many cases doubled, if not tripled. Mm-hmm. So we've seen the biggest theft of middle class wealth in history right in front of our eyes, number one. Number two, you get a national debt that's over $30 trillion. Then you drive up inflation, which is Biden's doing it right now. This is a controlled collapse. They're doing this on purpose. Why else would you, send $50 billion to Ukraine when your own country doesn't have baby formula?
That's right.
Inflation is going up. The American dollar has been devalued. You know, Saudi Arabia and Russia both are switching from using the dollar for like petrodollars or doing energy purchases to the digital yuan.
Yes.
So the dollar, people are losing confidence in the American dollar, American currency, American power. Now, most people don't realize what's going to happen by 2026. According to congressional data, Medicare will go bankrupt. Wait, 2026. Isn't that when Klaus Schwab said in 2016 that within 10 years, by 2026, every single human being will be tagged by a digital identifier?
Yes.
Let's put the puzzle together. What will happen to American economy? And then since everything's intertwined, remember in 2008, the housing crisis?
Mm-hmm.
Things globalized within 2-3 days.
Right.
Because all the economies are intertwined. What do you think is going to happen to the world economic stability when Medicare begins to tank? There will be a lot of turbulence. There'll be a crisis. It's going to be hyped up by the media. And then you never let a good crisis go to waste. That will be a pretext to switch really the world to a one world digital cryptocurrency controlled by a few degenerates. And basically, now you have a global power that controls global transactions. It's called the World Economic Forum for a reason. Because now the main weapon is controlling the economies, controlling people's resources.
So, God bless him. That's Vladimir Zelenko, passed away this week. Trump's doctor, but also very prolific, talking about the poison death jab through the plandemic. And also he's in this interview, he also talks about you know, why he believes in God, and he thinks that God definitely has some sort of a role in what's going on.
There are two ways to handle this one. We can usher in goodness into the world, because actually we're responsible. What do I mean by that? We as a society, as humanity, made really bad choices for a very long time. What do I mean? We desecrated life,
right.
Desecrated marriage, we desecrated gender. We've codified immorality into law. We've created a society that's analogous to Sodom and Gomorrah. They were destroyed because they codified immorality into the law. That's why I'm, in one way, very grateful to President Trump, because he moved the federal judiciary to the right. He put over 300 justices, not only the Supreme Court justices, but the lower courts, with the right-leaning, you know, people that have traditional godly values, we hope. And so that does shift the moral compass of this country towards the right, and I hope that will lead to, let's say, the reversal of Roe versus Wade, which we're on the verge of potentially seeing. But that would be, in many ways, a credit to President Trump, because he instilled justices that live by a moral standard. Now, all these justices are brilliant. The problem is that if you start with a foundational values that are garbage, so your conclusions
are garbage.
Right. It's not that they're not smart, but their values are godless. So their conclusions will be godless. Anyway, so... So we've allowed, we created a metaphysical vacuum where God doesn't really want to reveal himself. Why would he? If I was God, I was thinking, why would I want this world to continue? Look at the disgusting thing. People forget about me. And they turn to worship science and technology and all these corrupt governments. And they do everything that's against my will. So that creates a vacuum where forces of evil, like these people, which if you, in my opinion, sum total who they are, they represent the distillation product of the primordial serpent. And they thrive. So one way that's actually doable is a internal resolution to improve your moral and spiritual foundation and really turn away from the worship of falseness and false gods, and reconcile our hearts with the Creator.
And Vladimir Zelenko also saw life as a miracle.
We live a finite period of time, so whether it's 20 years or 100 years, but in the grand scheme of creation and in relation to the infinite, it's insignificant. Mm-hmm. But what is absolutely remarkable, amazing, miraculous, is that God gives us consciousness and free choice, puts us into a realm of finite, limited existence, and allows us to connect through our actions with the eternal and the infinite. So you think I'm going to give up one nanosecond for some temporary, transient pleasure or peace of mind? In lieu of connecting to the eternal? I mean, there's no choice there. If you think about it, it's completely irrelevant. And yes, I'm ready to die. First of all, I've been on that verge between life and death for 4 years. And so when you live at that address, a lot of things can happen, but I've resolved to surrender. Not give up, but surrender to whatever God will choose to do with me. I accept. Everything he does is perfect and good. But at the same time, you know, it's like when I practice medicine, it's a kind of a paradox. Because I'm nothing. God is the healer. And I'll pray to God that please let help this patient. But when I go see that patient, I will do everything in my power, my knowledge, my experience to help the patient. So it's like a I do everything I can, but and at the same time, message that it's all God. So it's a kind of a paradox, but it makes sense. And so the same here. So I know I stepped on the toes of the most evil forces on the planet. For example, there's a good reason they should be afraid of me, because I found an approach that, for example, will eliminate influenza virus and prevent influenza virus by over-the-counter natural means and put out a $15 billion flu shot industry, just like this. They better be afraid.
Yeah, they better be afraid. That's Vladimir Zelenko, bless him, passed away Wednesday this week, aged 48 years. Martin, figures like him, I think, are quite important in that he is exactly the sort of person that the algorithms want to shut out, but yet his voice has been quite strong throughout the pandemic for anybody that wanted to find out an alternative narrative. Simply because he was saying something completely different. And also, as he says right at the very end there, he is a serious threat to the pharmaceutical companies.
Well, he's got his views. And of course, he hasn't been that cancelled because you've heard of him and you've got all these.
He's been totally cancelled from anything to do with the mainstream media in this country. He's just not been mentioned at all.
Well, you'll find that most people don't agree with him about his views about religion.
Well, most editors, no.
No. So he's entitled to his views, but
surely his views about religion don't really have anything to do with his abilities as a doctor, do they?
No. So, and also his views about economics and politics are, he's entitled to them, but as a doctor, he's not an expert. He's just giving his views on economics and politics. Mm. He liked President Trump. President Trump assassinated Soleimani, General Soleimani from Iran, and nearly started World War III. And if he had started World War III, what would God have had to say about
well,
that?
But you see, you know, what you're doing is you're picking there away at something that Trump has done that's negative. This guy was working with him, and to try and save Trump's life. And a doctor is not responsible for what Trump has done to Soleimani any more than, you know, you or I are.
No, and he's entitled to his view. But as a left-wing member of the British Labour Party with Irish Republican sympathies, you can't expect that I'm going to go rah, rah, rah for Donald Trump. Why would I?
Well, no, but maybe we can for Zelenko and some of his ideas that he put across.
I'm all in favour of people saying what they think, but no crime for mummies when other people say what they think. The collapse of the United States is nothing to do with too much abortion or gay rights. It's to do with the military-industrial complex and the millions of people who died in Korea and Vietnam and all the other places that they've destroyed and all the children that they've burned to death. And that's the real moral outrage. And, of course, that's settled by war, not by talk.
Well, it'd be interesting if Vladimir Zelenko could come back on you there, but unfortunately he can't. As I say, he died age 48 this week. And just as part of this kind of over COVID, I had a chat this week, a little podcast which I put up online yesterday as a video, actually, but I'll put it up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk with the journalist from Lancashire, Henry Widders. He's works on one of the mainstream press titles up there, and he's part of one of the founders of this Holding the Line group, which I'm also part of, and also he's a union rep for the National Union of Journalists. So here is a little bit of a discussion that we had as part of that podcast, where Henry and I discuss Julian Assange. Almost every week we hear a little bit more about Assange, and we'll probably be hearing more next week.
I mentioned the Light newspaper, and I do some sub-editing for that. And in the July edition, they're covering Assange. So I didn't know much about that topic, but I've read a very in-depth article about it just recently. And, hopefully you won't get extradited, you know, but I think it's going to the very last level of appeal now. So it's flip of a coin, depends who the law lord is, who's going to be covering it. And then, you know, if he is going to go over to the US, there has to be huge amounts of scrutiny of how he's being treated. And, you know, to move to another journalist, there was a Saudi Arabian one from memory who, you know, had his fingers chopped off. So imagine being a journalist in Saudi Arabia now thinking, oh, I want to hold authority to account. They're just not going to do it if they know they're at personal risk. And that's another fantastic thing the National Union of Journalists does. It raises the issue of journalists being, like, you know, physically threatened and killed across the world. You know, it's not uncommon for journalists to be getting killed around the world. That's another reason we're lucky, of course, where we are in you know, the Western Hemisphere. You know, it doesn't happen, journalists getting killed, but it does elsewhere. So, yeah, with Assange, you know, it just has to have lots of public scrutiny, hopefully within the mainstream and independent media. But we debated about this before. I mean, I've said to you I know nothing about it, but I know people who are respected journalists like Richard D. Hall who have suspicions that Assange might be controlled opposition. That's another debate I'd like to get into, that term controlled opposition, because I'm not sure I buy it. I think everyone's just got differences of opinion. So,
well, I think Assange has massively embarrassed the, you know, the US behemoth. The other thing, of course, is that the whole process of, you know, incarcerating Assange and this whole business of getting him extradited in a situation where he hasn't actually committed any British crime surely is a crime in itself. The people involved in that have been perverting the course of justice, and they should themselves be behind bars rather than Julian. But anyway, I think, you know...
Well, just on that topic, I mean, those are sort of quite strong allegations against the courts. So, you know, you have to, if you're going to be reporting on it, yeah, you have to be aware of all the legal aspects. You know, as a former crime reporter, I had lots of law training, and you can't go making allegations like that unless you're confident that you could support those allegations in the court itself. So if you're going to accuse a court of corruption, you have to think, have I got the evidence here to prove in another court that that's the case?
Well, I would be more than happy.
Just go back to the controlled opposition aspect.
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that, Henry, personally. I mean, through the personal connections of the judges and this kind of, and just basically looking at the law of the land to do with the way extradition is supposed to work, this is just complete...
Well, yeah, conflicts of interest should be able to be reported. That's 100%. And, you know,
well, for example, a judge should stand aside when a conflict of interest is pointed out, but this one has...
Yeah, I mean, there was a case like that in the Northwest where... I think three people were jailed in like a sort of very quick court process for trying to disrupt some of the fracking that was going on near Blackpool. And then it transpired that the magistrate or the judge who sentenced them was a relative or something of someone who had a financial interest in the fracking companies. So, yeah, those jail sentences were quickly quashed and they were given community sentences. So, yeah, there's a great example of, you know, journalists. I think it was Craig Murray actually who raised the issue. Another journalist who's been jailed in this country, by the way, unfortunately. But I don't know much about the details there. But anyway, before I get sidetracked too much, the Assange-controlled opposition debate is about how he was set up to then have people funneling information that then the American government could find out who was funneling the information to, Assange would reveal to the government, right, X and Y have been giving me documents. But it doesn't really stack up that argument to me, because the amount of harm that WikiLeaks has caused the American government is so massive. Would they really have set up someone to, enable whistleblowers to cause them devastating harm?
So from holding the line, Henry Widdes there, making sure we're keeping freedom of speech alive, man. But Martin, this is an interesting point he's making there about saying, well, I mean, for example, Richard E. Hall, he mentions, Richard E. Hall thinks that the World Trade Center was hit by either missiles or holograms, certainly not aircraft. So I don't know how respected Richard E. Hall is as a journalist, but he's making this difference between controlled opposition and differences of opinion. And I suppose, you need to make a decision as to whether you think someone that has a difference of opinion has a kind of hidden lobby behind that difference of opinion, and whether that's a lobby which is actually pushing its agenda through a kind of front operation, something like Bellingcat, for example.
Well, I don't think there's much doubt about Bellingcat. It's funded by NATO intelligence services, but it pretends to be an independent citizen journalist organisation. Incidentally, of course, all of the people on Bellingcat get nice little salaries for what they do, unlike what we're doing at the moment.
Unlike us, yeah. Julian Assange, by the way, today has filed his High Court appeal against extradition, and supporters have staged protests ahead of his 51st birthday tomorrow. I understand there's a party going on in London tomorrow lunchtime. The WikiLeaks founder, age 50, is due to be extradited to the US for espionage. He's trying to stop the extradition through appeals as he remains in prison, held in Belmarsh since he's dragged out of the Ecuadorian embassy in 2019. He'd been in there since 2012 and he was under house arrest. Before that, his wife Stella has joined supporters outside the Home Office today to protest Priti Patel's decision to approve his extradition. So, Martin, all happening now, the appeal's been filed. It does seem as if this could almost drag on forever, but this is all, of course, appalling for Julian Assange, who's actually not committed any crime here in Britain whatsoever.
Well, also, of course, it has the effect of terrifying journalists in the mainstream who just realise that, you know, this is far too dangerous.
Well, not necessarily, because to a certain extent it's galvanising many journalists behind him, isn't it?
Well, I think there's a bit of a struggle going on, isn't there? Between, I mean, The Guardian, of course, have washed his hands of Assange, but they still have to occasionally make a little bleat in the opinion, in the leader saying that he ought to be released. So it puts them in a very uncomfortable position. But, I mean, there's very interesting stuff on the grey zone at the moment about Carol Cadwalader and Paul Mason and their intimate relationship with the intelligence services. Jonathan Cook, who used to be based in the West Bank, has written two very good articles about all of this.
But, yeah, very good point. And this is clearly being done specifically as these leaked emails from Paul Mason. This is to destroy alternative voices. They're not just trying to put their point of view, which they've already got, swamping the mainstream press. They're also saying even the tiny little minnows, like maybe like this show, but actually the Grey Zone is quite a lot bigger than us, but attempts to use legal attacks to destroy the Grey Zone. So Paul Mason, of course, we have to say here, is not a journalist at all. He's a hitman for the various lobbies that are paying him or that he's working very closely with the intelligence services.
Well, what Jonathan Cook points out in his latest articles on the Grey Zone is it may be that Paul Mason is actually volunteering himself to be the hitman for the intelligence
services.
Could be, They haven't actually recruited him.
Maybe.
I think he's becoming a rather grotesque figure. But I think the answer to all of this is the world is a hell of a lot more complicated than most people think. There are people paid big salaries to try and bend your mind.
Yeah.
Whether it's to sell you cornflakes or a war in Ukraine.
Well, that's right.
And they earn their money by creating all kinds of counter narratives.
Hopefully, we are causing a few problems for them. We're going to wind up this week with one of the champions of freedom around the world. Some people dislike intensely because of his opposition to climate change narratives and zero carbon narratives and things like decarbonisation, which our Bristol mayor seems to think is some sort of wonderful achievement, is Piers Corbyn. He went this week to one of these Just Stop Oil marches to make his point and to try and engage him in some sort of discussion about the whole climate debate.
I'm Piers Corbyn of Let the UK Live and the website lettheuklive.com and stopnewnormal.net, which is our main information site. And we have just launched a new campaign called March 4 More CO2. And it's a number 4 if you want the hashtag for it. And we are calling upon the Extinction Rebellion extension into what they call Just Stop Oil, which is now aligned with my brother and who set up his Peace and Justice campaign. So they've got a Peace and Justice and Just Stop Oil joined together. Now, we're challenging these people to have an actual discussion about the evidence for so-called man-made climate change, because there is none. So we are going to any of their events and meetings just asking politely for evidence. The actual facts are that carbon dioxide level changes follow changes in world temperatures. And we have pamphlets on that and leaflets. And they have no answer. But, you know, if they can come up with an answer, fine. but we challenged them to produce one scientific paper using real data, not computerized stuff, real data, which shows that their claim of temperature changes following CO2. The reality is the opposite way. So that's what we're doing. We'll be appearing.
Just a minute, Piers, because this Just Stop Oil campaign is really part of Extinction Rebellion, isn't it? It's the campaign that was involved in stopping the cars on the motorways, which seemed to be counterproductive, since these are the people that actually the campaigners should be trying to persuade to get on side. But, of course, that has also led to this clampdown by Priti Patel on all protest.
Of course. So you see, XR and their sidekicks, which is Just Stop Oil, or now my brother joining them, which I think is, I've supported my brother since he was age 15. But it's only now that I'm actually opposing anything he's doing. And that is this. It's a disgrace that he's joining this thing. Because after all, he's now following the narrative of Keir Starmer and Boris, who are talking nonsense about green stuff all the time. And the purpose of their campaign is not to control climate, it's to control you.
Yeah, but it sounds to me like you're in denial that there is any kind of problem with global warming or climate change.
Correct, I am in. I deny that completely. There is natural climate change, and I do long-range forecasting, and we predicted the warm weather in June, for example. But the CO2 lobby can't predict anything at all, because they don't understand that solar activity is that which is controlling climate. And there's not, frankly, much mankind can do about solar activity.
But, I mean, this is becoming the absolute foundation for energy policy and also taxation. The things like the tax on emissions in London, soon to come in Bristol and other cities too.
Yeah, and, of course, the ultra-low emission zones and all that nonsense to deny your right to drive an oldish car around anywhere. I mean, it is a monstrosity. It's a religious operation to justify basically anything they want. A climate lockdown, a climate virus lockdown, extra tax on petrol. It is complete madness, and we're out to get the root and branch of their ideology.
Well, I know Extinction Rebellion are having some problems in attracting quite so many people as they were a couple of years ago before the pandemic to their demonstrations. But Martin, the Just Stop Oil's recent action has been to do with oil paintings. I know just today they're gluing themselves to the frame of Turner paintings in Manchester and trying to drill into why they're doing this. They're saying, well, it just seems to be a way to try and keep ourselves in the news. There's no actual reason to glue themselves to a painting.
Well, obviously there's a massive bunch of issues there. I might agree with some things Piers Corbyn says and other things I might not agree with. There should be a proper debate about all of this. In Colombia, where the left have just won the first election ever, people are opposed to BP, for example, developing the Casanare field because they assassinate local social movement leaders. And they don't want foreign oil companies coming into rural areas in Latin America to find oil. And it's nothing to do with climate change. It's to do with indigenous rights.
But isn't some of this anti-oil stuff is actually coming from the oil companies themselves? Because they want to get into other forms of energy. They know that if there is war breaks out, that they won't be able to get their oil from the Middle East anymore.
Well, I think the evidence shows that the oil companies, they've been trying to prevent. There's lots of internal documents that show that they were aware of the danger of potential climate change going back to the 1950s. But if there is going to be change, they want to be in charge of it. You can be sure of that.
Yeah, what do you make of what I'm saying about the potential for war cutting off their oil supplies? So these energy companies really aren't so keen on oil anymore. They want new forms of energy that they can control.
Yes. And there's all kinds of struggles going on about who's going to control the direction of what's happening. And there's probably going to be a massive decrease in our carbon footprint when we get into the real depression that's coming around the corner. And people will be more worried about putting food on the table than they will about the potential for climate change. But on the other hand, oil companies, we don't forget, in the past we used to talk about peak oil, that maybe there isn't enough oil. and that in actual fact it's running out, and that's why the price is going up, and our society is totally based on using oil. And even if climate change didn't exist, we'd have to do something about that. And we're not doing
well. That was a deal which was
no planet.
That was a deal which was struck between, was it? No, it wasn't. I think it was Truman. I think it was Roosevelt and Abdulaziz, wasn't it, at the Bitter Lake meeting in 1944?
Yes, of course,
a massive deal that the Americans did with the Saudis, and then of course they got the whole of the Western world, particularly including us here, shutting down our railways, hooked on oil deliberately.
That's right. That's right. I mean, and these things, these debates were being had before anybody mentioned stuff about climate change. The question is, how are we going to manage the global commons? And, of course, the powerful forces that are at work are trying to make sure that whatever happens, they end up on top.
Well, yes, and also that we use much more energy than we need to, because, you know, even if you go back to my childhood, we had a very, you know, efficient, quick, easy-to-use public transport system. You just walk down the road, hop on a bus, they come along every 5 minutes or so, and then when you get to the other end, you hop on a train, which are regular every 15 minutes, maybe 20 minutes, and you get wherever it is you want to go at cost, rather than, you know, the whole idea of using a private car and setting the rail fares, for example, so that they are just sometimes quite considerably more than it's going to cost you to go in the car. So as the oil prices are going up, so of course rail fares have also been going up alongside, you know, maybe even slightly more than inflation. So the whole cost of transport is becoming a massive racket, and the idea that we can go back to at cost public transport seems further away than ever, Martin.
Yes, except that, as we were talking to the trade union activist earlier, the RMT are on their picket lines, and probably they're going to be on their picket lines again soon enough, and climate change activists have been joining them. Now, in actual fact, we all share, and I presume Piers Corbyn would share, that we need affordable, cheap, efficient public transport. That's common ground, surely.
Okay, well, we'll
so
see,
instead of bickering, why don't we all get together and do it?
Well, let's see where all this goes, because on 27th of July, Extinction Rebellion is planning a mass protest in London in collaboration with Jeremy Corbyn's Peace and Justice Project under the banner "We All Want to Just Stop Oil." Well, maybe this is quite convenient for the warmongers that want to have war in the Middle East. But anyway, that will be interesting, because I'm sure Piers Corbyn will be down there doing his putting his oar in with that. But finally tonight, let's hear from Piers, who there's been a very important court case this week, which has hardly been reported at all, which is what were called the Freedom Five. These are the people who were given enormous, massive five-figure fines for organising protests during the lockdowns.
Well, there's a lot of cases have been banking up after all our protests where we've been resisting the New World Tyranny. The most recent one, very important result, was for the Freedom Five, the five of us who were involved in key organising of big demonstrations in 2020. And the last three of us were on trial, and that terminated a couple of days ago. And we were potentially going to get fines. I could have had fines of £40,000 and the others £30,000, because I was involved in one more demonstration than them. In fact, my fine was only £1,285, and the lowest of the other two was £285. So you see, that's quite remarkable. The judge is basically, well, he's found us guilty, but not on all counts, found us guilty, but given this actually low fines, because it doesn't deter me from anything. I'm going to carry on organising. And I think the judge is actually recognising that, you know, the mood has changed. People can now see that actually we were right to do all those marches, because if not, where would we be now? Would we be locked up in a permanent lockdown and new fascism? Who knows? Now, an important thing about these judgments was that the judge found us not guilty of anything about holding demonstrations in November, because at that time of that demonstration, the police had actually were using the law wrong rules. And that means that everybody who got arrested on those marches, or any march in November period, was actually wrongfully arrested and can sue the police. So we're going to be organising that. And it may be that the other demonstrations, namely in August, September, October, we could have an appeal on. And the December one, which was my New Year's Eve event where I was blowing fire on New Year's Eve at the Millennium Wheel. That could also appeal on that. I don't know. But see, there's an important principle involved, namely that they're attacking our right to free speech and assembly. Main way we're spending money right now is on these leaflets for the March for More CO2, for example. So anyone who wants to fund us, please get online. Go to stopnewnormal.net or lettheuklive.com and subscribe on the links there.
That's Piers Corbyn. Important cases, Martin, and possibly, you know, important precedents being set there. Certainly a very clear signal from the courts that they believed that Matt Hancock's fines were far too high. You know, the idea that it's going to be a five-figure sum for organising a demonstration, and the courts have sent a message accordingly. So I'll put a link up also to the report from that court report on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. I do see a lot of evidence, and this is including the recent Priti Patel Act, Martin, that there seems to be a great dislike of the people getting together and protesting, and particularly over the freedom of speech, either at a protest or online. We're moving into rather dark times where it's almost Orwellian situation where there is an official way you're supposed to think, and if you're not, you're a kind of thought criminal of one sort or another.
Well, it's been going in that direction for many years, and as this crisis intensifies, no doubt it's going to get worse. But people will fight back in various ways, and we will see what the results are going to be.
We certainly will. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Also in the first hour, Justin Thomas from the PCS, Public and Commercial Services Union, the Civil Servants Union, with, we estimate, roughly 400,000 members. Amazing if you think about it. All those Labour Party members and the PCS members got together against the Tories, 160,000 members of the Conservative Party. These are important organisations that represent vast numbers of people democratically. And those people, at least in the unions, can make decisions through their unions' democratic processes and do things like they vote for how much salary the General Secretary should have, that sort of thing. It would be nice if we could vote that with our MPs, wouldn't it? Ourselves, as individuals, put a little sort of chitty in the post as to how much they should get. So anyway, thanks to Martin Summers, to Justin Thomas, and also to our sound engineer Dave Buzanko, who managed to get Martin back on the line there after some sort of problem with a sound card, it sounds like. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Do please send me interviews and story tips via Not the BCFM Politics Show page, where you'll find our email addresses. And you'll also find this podcast and full-length interviews, story links, and our email addresses. So, and also, you can subscribe to my weekly email out, and even donate if you feel so inclined at thisweekoneword.org.uk. Another way you can help out is to get a paperback. I've got my paperbacks about the deals between the Allies and the Nazis during the war, the Bilderbergers and the Battle of Arnhem. Costs £15. It's called The Traitors of Arnhem. And also my secret government anthology, From Cromwell to the Princess Diana Assassination. The Siege of Heaven reader is on eBay, and the Siege of Heaven ebook and links to all of them are at bilderberg.org. Also, a bit of an update to the article I did, the investigation I did on the English Civil War, with something I actually just only discovered this week, which is this Providence Island group of Puritans who were so very active during the attempt of the King to rule. It was almost like a kind of alternative Puritan City of London Parliament that was going on, whilst the King Charles I was attempting to rule without Parliament. The Parliament decided to convene itself in this peculiar group that were associated with this island off Nicaragua, which was supposed to be a perfect Puritan colony. Of course, it didn't really look as if it had anything much to do with that. It was more to do with opposing the King and getting organised to fight the King back here in Britain. Anyway, so that is, I'll put that complete article up on our show page this week at thisweek.org.uk. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week, along with many of the restreamings of the Richie Allen Show. And over Sunday lunch at Camberley's RadioQUK.com, do please feel free to make live recordings in case something goes wrong with our recording. We've been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft in Bristol on the new talkradio.org.uk stream, and also at RadioQUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. So, have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream on talkradio.org.uk at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Tomorrow in each of us is a hidden sorrow.